hell happened? Okay, ji. Let me start. Ji. Can everybody see my screen?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Except I can't see it myself. I know it's kind of strange. Okay, here it is. Thank you. Well, folks, thank you very much. Thanks for coming to the PID webinar. We are trying very hard to enliven a debate and try and understand what's happening in Pakistan. So, yeah, Hamari Financial Markets ki third in a series. We are trying to develop series of these because I think the issues are very complex and we can't deal with them in one go. And we have to learn from market participants. That's why we'd like to invite you people and we'd like to invite more of you to understand the issue. Data hame kuch batata hai, but there is a lot more knowledge that you guys give us. So, pehli cheez to ye administrative cheez nahi hai. Might mics mute kar le. Speakers ko pehle bolne de. Then after that you can do, you can raise your hands or you can come in. I mean, we give everybody a chance to speak. It's not a question of anybody monopolizing the debate, but we think the speakers have a certain expertise. That's why they are given the first chance to speak. We don't want a debate like TV. We want a much more informed debate. ये जो कार्टून लगाया है ये इसलिए लगाया कि सबके सामने याद रहे कि हम IMF के मोहताज रहे हैं for the last so many years. तो ये हमारा पैनल है जी. I'm very grateful to Naseem sahab for organizing it. We've got several of the best people in the financial markets, and this is exactly what we intend to do, to talk to as many of them as possible to learn. Our job is to learn here. So, Sayyed Ali Sultan, Group Head, Treasury and Capital Markets, Bank Al-Fala. Naz Khan, Chief Strategy Officer, Karachi Electric. Farooq Khan, CEO, PSX. Mohammed Asim, CIO, MCB, RF Habib Savings and Investment, a very large fund group. Habibur Rahman, Director, Atlas Management Group, another large fund group. Mohammed Ali Ahmed, ED and Chief Strategy Officer, EFU Life, which is again another very important insurance group. Dr. Amjad Wahid, Mutual Funds of NBP. And Zafar Masood Saab, I don't know whether he can join us or not after his traumatic experience.
No, yesterday I checked with his brother. He was in hospital.
No, I appreciate that. We all wish him well. We all wish him a speedy recovery. That is a sad, sad tragedy to happen in the middle of COVID. And we all, we all sort of feeling sorry for the relatives and the people who passed away, some very good friends of all of us. But tragedies happen. So we'll move on. But let me just say this. Naseem Beg Saab, and I urge all of you to do this, please, because knowledge is nobody's domain. Knowledge is nobody's personal issue. Naseem Beg Saab helped arrange all this. Naseem Beg Saab did everything. In fact, I had asked him to moderate, but he didn't want to. But truly, this is his session. He arranged it. And I'm extremely thankful to him. And this session would not be complete without us all thanking Naseem Beg Saab for taking this initiative, for guiding us, for helping us. So Naseem Saab, thank you very much. Now, let me move on. I have a very short presentation, folks. I don't want to take up your time. But then I have questions for each of you because it's a big panel. So we'll all just go through the questions and keep your answers short. And I want this to be as information full as possible. So that's fine. Any question? Because it's a big panel, we directed the questions at you, but you're free to just tell us whenever you want to jump in, okay? I just want this slide I show every webinar because I think every one of us, all Pakistani citizens, should know that there has not been a decade when we've not been a fund program. Fund program is like the emergency ward. So we are a country that goes to the emergency ward every 3 or 4 years. I think we all should be sad and aware of this, that somehow we can't take responsibility for ourselves, and we should be very, very clear on that. Next thing that I think we should all keep in front of us, our long-run growth is declining. Our long-run growth is declining. We have a volatile growth rate to a long-run growth rate that is declining. That is sad. That is extremely sad. We are probably the only country where this is happening, or maybe there are a few other basket cases, but yeah, this is the basket case. The next thing I want you to see is our savings rate. Our savings rate is well below India, although I must say it's a bit surprising, still remains within the South Asian region. Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal are not doing well too. But I think we should try and do better. We should not be in the Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal range. So what is wrong with our savings rate? That's going to be one of the questions before you folks. Then our total investment rate, it's the worst in the region. I mean, it's below everybody. It doesn't seem to go up. It seemed to be going down. And this should concern the markets people a lot, because after all, that's where investment happens. So this is why I thought I'd place these charts before you so that we go ahead. Now, equity market, Naseem Saab gave me some data. Equity market, you can see, very well. Market capitalization is very low. In fact, it's lower than many countries. The listed number of listed companies is minuscule, 534. Out of which many of them don't even trade, and many of them are defaulters, and many of them are multinational companies that don't even want to list. So we're kind of inflating the company. Then government companies are the largest, which is very, very strange. Debt market hardly exists. It's really a government bond market. There's no debt market. And it says saving rate is very low. Now, let me put you, we've had previous seminars. Let me just quickly summarize what we've learned. First, we've learned that capital markets have no risk or growth capital. No, there should be a no there. They have no big, risk or growth capital. Khalid Mirza was very critical. He said these markets are just not. And Khalid Mirza, he was the former chairman of the policy board as well as the stock exchange, SECP, etc. Banks are the agents of government. We know that very well. Stock market is too shallow and thin. There's not enough script. There are few listings. There's state control in the companies, government control everywhere. And there are no entrepreneurs. Big government companies are the big players. Multinationals are the second player. Small companies are a distant third, and our local companies. Local companies are a distant third and are very small. I was surprised to learn our largest company, Engro, is like $1.5 billion, which in the international world is a SME. So we have SMEs. We really don't have big companies, and we have no multinationals, Pakistani-based multinationals. A previous webinar also told us that bond markets don't exist and instruments, there are no instruments in the market. REIT happened, a lot of effort was put in, but there's only one REIT, and that also happened after the mall was built. Yeah, only one REIT after for 11 years, that's a lot. That's saying a lot. we also did a seminar on corporates. We also did a seminar on when companies don't grow, and they agreed with us. We also did a seminar on investments, and they told us that state culture prevails widely in our corporates. Professionalism is at a low level. In fact, we did a seminar on HRM, and they told us that our companies are talent repellent. We don't really hunt talent. We just simply throw out talent if you can. There is no R&D. There's mainly lobbying. SRO culture prevails. We had a seminar with Hafiz Pasha the other day, Salman Shah. They were very critical that SRO culture prevails, and the SRO culture does not show a hunger for growth. In fact, our companies don't seem to have a hunger for growth. They're not building legacies like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, and that came as a big surprise to us. So we're going to pursue that further. Government policy is at the heart of the problem. The effective taxation rate is very high. After you take account of the documentation and all other costs, it's very high. Secondly, volatility of policy is huge. Policy is reactive, not proactive. Policy is business environment, business friendly. There is a huge suspicion of profit. So yeah, the government needs to change a lot, but so does the corporate sector. So there's a problem. Regulation, we were told by Khalid Mirza, is captured, non-professional. And the laws are very confused. So I'd like you guys to focus on the laws. Where are they confused? Khalid Mirza, etc., told us the laws are extremely confused. SECP law has so many lacunas in it. I don't know what the policy board is doing. Should there be a policy board? So all these things. The biggest indictment I saw is this former CEO, I think Maran, or what was his name? You probably know him better than I do. But I remember I kept his... he wrote an article and he gave some interviews, and his article said that the stock market is run through a broker bedroom. He also said that you can see the quote there. When I was pushed out of the door, very simply because the arrival of a foreigner at the helm of the stock exchange, one who is familiar with international best practices, constitutes an existential threat to legacy brokers who have long held a stranglehold in this market. Indeed, their attacks started as soon as my candidacy emerged months before I actually joined. So this is the background, folks. And I'd really like you to tell us, the trust is gone. But trust gone, how do we operate? So I'll run through a few questions that Naseem Beg helped me prepare. And then we'll take the discussion from there. So let's see. Sultan Saab, please bataiye. Okay, you know, debt government bonds are primarily held by financial institutions. They're a closed club. I mean, small investors can't participate. Yes, buy fund, but that's all we can do. How do we make these markets more accessible, especially to the small investor?
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank you and PIDE for inviting me on this webinar. I have attended several and well managed, and I'm proud to be part of the panelist. So this is the subject, I think since I started my career 25 years before, I'm hearing this subject. And Naseem Saab and other senior members, I would like to have a reverse question first rather than answering this. First, we need to really discuss what are the core issues and who to blame actually for not developing the debt market. This is the question. Regulators, issuers, ministry, central bank, SECP, or banks who have failed in financial intermediation process, or stock market players, those only understand equities. They talk generally on the forums on debt, developing the debt, but they don't understand debt. And only few brokers I have seen in the past, KSB, Jahangir Siddiqui, BMA, and few more, that's it, out of a list of 450 and so. So I think we need to really understand first. I can share my practitioner view. I'm a banker and I have also been a broker also. So I can just touch base two major core issues why market is not developing. Because I believe one is we call it from a banking sector ADR, advance to deposit ratio, which is if you have on one side time and demand liabilities, and other side banks create assets. So, and generally they lend close to 50 or much before 50% of the ADR in historical, and today also is the same. So 50% left to deploy, number one. So this is the core, why I'm saying this is the issue. So because we can talk, because lending to corporates is only 50, and 50 remains in hand. This is one part. Two is, I would say, anomaly, because government of Pakistan is the biggest borrower. And not only is the biggest borrower, because there is no concept of credit spreading on compared to the corporate and the government. Anomaly is that government, most of the time, they pay higher returns compared to the corporate borrowing, and we have seen number of times. So, and second is from a capital charge perspective, from a banker, it's easy money for them actually. They just go and invest, buy T-bills and government securities. There's no capital charge and pricing is fine and easy to sell and just make money at a time of changing interest rate scenario. And we have seen numbers. So these are two major issues. ADR, beyond control for anyone. SME, hardly, there's hardly only few large corporates, are the main borrower. So we need to really see the price anomaly. There should be a price difference between the corporate and the government, so that this shift can see happen. Second point, because I'm a banker now, so first let me blame bankers. I'm a banker, so and it's very open. I say very openly that really banks have failed in terms of their financial intermediation role and process when it comes to distribution of the government securities to the non-banking sectors as well as on the retail sector. Although central bank has attempted number of has done different attempts creating a framework of primary dealership, but it's still when we look at the broader number of the bifurcation of the total debt, holding banks versus non-banks, is it still the same? 75%, more than 75% holding with the banks, and hardly 25% is non-banks. And within the non-banks, thanks to asset management companies, by the way, when they have really established, they have started creating their funds. So money market fund, debt fund. So we can see this number has really, really grown up. So I think otherwise banks, they always talk deposit cannibalization, deposit. And I'm talking about the senior management, CEO and down. It's very difficult. And we have seen in last 25 years, banks, they only focus on deposit, number one. Because we need to talk about incentive also. When we see insurance companies, banker insurance banks, generally they sell banker insurance left, right, center. They get huge margins out of that. So why they go for a selling treasury bill and PIB where there's no proper margin on that? This is another angle. Coming back to stock players, stock market, they only understand equities. With all due respect, I have started my career from stock exchange, and still, we have seen several attempts in last government. Ministry of Finance has allowed treasury bill to list at the stock exchange, but unfortunately, still, I would say it was a failure because if there is no trade, there is no system. So I think we are still back to square one. So coming back to exact your question, how to increase? Okay, I think we can criticize, we can debate for long, but I think let's come up with certain ideas. I can share now, and this COVID-19 has imposed the system to go on the automation and digital. I think this digital meaning we have, for example, in 4 or 5 years before, we have established IPS trading platform where anyone can log in and can trade within three minutes or 4 minutes time. Within the financial institution, Bloomberg is there, but it's very expensive. And non-banking financial institution, they can access to primary dealership. But the challenge comes when we talk about the retailers. And you have rightly said, Pakistan has gone down in terms of their saving spectrum. So who to blame, actually? This is the question. So I think banks, ministry, central bank, everyone needs to be blamed here. And I think now let's come up with the platform so that they can give the access to everyone and they can trade. And we have, alhamdulillah, we have reached more than 1,000 individuals. Those are active players and participating directly to Central Bank of Pakistan primary auction and going for non-competitive bid auction and taking the stock of treasury bills and PIBs. So this is my experience. I think we need to encourage more and more electronic platforms. Every individual, and I can offer through this platform that I can give access to non-banks and individuals free of cost. And we have well-established electronic trading platform. Anyone can log in and can see. I can answer more and more. This is the thought which I would like to share with you guys.
Thank you very much. Nasab, let me turn to you. You are the Chief Strategy Officer of Karachi Electric. I'd like to understand first that you remain a very insignificant player in the corporate paper market. You know, the numbers are there, you can see them. Government bonds are huge, you are like almost negligible. But I'd like to go further. What is your corporate finance strategy? I'm talking to you because as a representative of the market, because I see the corporate finance doesn't seem to use the markets at all. All corporate finance does, and I hear this every day from leaders of business and on channels, that they want the interest rate to come down. Would I be wrong if I said the interest rate should go to 25? Because let's force these guys to use equity and corporate paper and government and corporate bonds, because if the interest, it seems debt is too cheap to me, and you have no desire for any market. Secondly, again, you are, Karachi Electric has been going to China to sell itself. Why are you not using the local markets to raise funds if you need funds? Why are you not using the stock market or the government pay or the corporate paper market or whatever? Why can't you use these markets? So please, go ahead, Nasa.
Thank you, Dr. Saab, and a pleasure to be here. You know, when Naseem Saab told me about this seminar and the topic, and I said, you know,
I apologize. I apologize.
No issue. So I asked him the question that should I just pull out my presentations from 15 years ago? Because as Ali said, it seems to be the same presentation then and now. So first, let me just talk about Karachi Electric. Karachi Electric, by the way, has been the largest private sector issuer on debt and is in the process of doing the largest private sector, corporate debt issue as we speak. And I'll come to that later. So to your question on what holds retail investors back, nothing really holds retail investors back, actually. I mean, keep in mind that there are 7 million plus investors in national savings schemes, okay? And it's 4.2 trillion rupees, right? So while I may not have the breakup for retail and institutional, but institutional investors, only employee benefit funds, etc., are allowed. Otherwise, it's primarily retail. So the retail investors actually have a flourishing debt market. They love debt much more than they do equity. Equity, there are only 200,000 plus CDC investors. So they understand debt, they like debt, and their need is being serviced from there, right? The question to really ask is what is holding corporate issuers back, right? And as a corporate issuer, what is the compelling reason for you to use the corporate debt market? And I can tell you, being part of KE and previously part of Engro, number one, either you are in a high growth mode, you are going into projects, you are expanding, you want to diversify your sources of funding away from the banking sector. Hence, you go out and you tap the corporate debt market. Number two, your borrowing needs may be greater than what the banking lines can afford you, right? So you may want to go and again, go to other sources of funding. But then again, remember, the way you do this is you will go to the banks. The next, you will go to our institutional investors who will offer you a similar rate of return. Institutional investors being, other than banks, are mutual funds, insurance companies, employee benefit funds. You will go to them. Retail investor is your third port of call if your need is that high. So when will you worry about corporate debt? When you really have that need. And when will you worry about the retail investor? When your need is even greater. And frankly, it's exactly like you said. There just isn't enough of that need. Where is the real need residing? It's actually with the large entities. And those large entities are primarily government because you haven't privatized. So look at the example of KE. I mean, you have WAPDA has been unbundled. You've got the DISCOs and you've got the NTDC. I mean, the need is there. None of them have been privatized. So it's the government borrowing. Today, KE has been privatized, so KE is out there borrowing because the needs are there. It's a 300 billion market, top line company. You know, if KE had not been privatized, you would not have been out there in the market borrowing right now. So that's one thing, right? So a large part of your corporate sector, the one that has the requirement, is government. So that's one thing. Third point, and the most important, really, is when you go to a retail investor, you need to compete with national savings schemes. Now, let me give you the example of KE. KE, by the way, up to now, over the last 5-6 years, has issued over 100 billion rupees worth of short-term and long-term corporate debt, right? And it has currently about close to 50 billion of that outstanding at this point in time. And as we speak, it is in the process of doing a 25 billion rated listed sukuk, which is the largest ever done by a private sector. The pre-IPO is closed. The IPO is expected within a month. Now look at KE's example. When KE was pricing the pre-IPO was happening somewhere in December. Your national savings rate at that point in time, till a month before the pricing, was close to 14.76%. And I'm taking the pensioners and the Behbud rate simply because when I look at the retail investors that come into the corporate debt, having done some research on this, half of them are 60 and above. So I'm taking that rate. Even if you don't take that rate, the other rate is 2% lower. KE was giving 15.25%, but it's a floating rate, right? Because obviously as a corporate, I don't want to be locked in at that rate. Within these 4-5 months, the IPO hasn't even happened for that instrument. KE is now priced at 9.84%, whereas the investor that locked into the national savings is getting over 14.5%.
Mm-hmm.
So as a corporate issuer, I will not take that risk. I mean, I have saved over 5%. So the retail investor has made the right choice. The corporate issuer has made the right choice. So really, the needs are being satisfied. So who are you trying to serve here? So the requirement is not there. Everyone's needs at this point in time are being satisfied. The issuers and the investors are making very rational and sensible choices.
But let me ask you a question. Madam, why are you not offering any equity for investment? Why are you focused primarily on debt? I've always wondered, why do our corporates not offer equity as a choice of investment?
Well, so at this point in time, when you have the ability to take on, I mean, it's smart to take on some debt, right? At least up to some point in time, because it makes sense for you. Financially, it makes sense for you, right? And at some point in time, when you get to a certain debt level, then yes, you start considering equity. But if I can take debt, it's a smart choice. If I can pay that off, and why take on permanent capital when I can do that to borrowed capital and repay that? So, I mean, it's just a financial choice.
But this is my question, that it seems that debt is too cheap in this market. So when these SETs come on the television, or your brokers come on television and tell me that the rate is too high at 14, would I be wrong if I said that the rate should be 25 so that equities are locked?
No. I mean, you have to look at the risk, right? And the risk for debt versus the risk for equity. And there has to be a difference over there. Right? I mean, if you look at the number, like you said, the number of defaulting companies on the stock exchange, or you see that we were 750 listed companies, we've gone down. So, I mean, there is a cost to that equity, and it's definitely higher than the risk that you take on the debt side. So, no, your debt cost has to be lower.
Fair enough. So, basically, there's a preference for equity. People don't like to unlock equity. That's fine. We shall accept it and move on.
Doctor, if I can just complete. I think the important thing is, there are structural issues that you need to address in the national savings schemes. Mm. There is no reason why the government needs to be paying that kind of rate of return. The PIB has come down. But you've given people a put op. I mean, you've effectively given people a put option on the national savings. So interest rates have come down, but I'm still locked in, at that rate. Or when the interest rates are moving up, I can just put it back to the government and go take the higher rate. So the government will always be paying the higher rate. So if I were to consider national savings as the government's corporate debt, so to speak, I guarantee you the average rate of borrowing for the government on that is higher than what the corporates are paying.
Yeah. That it is. I agree with you. You're certainly right. And that's part of the government debt management strategy that they really, I mean, if you take the commodity finance, then it's even higher. If you take what they do for the IPP finance, that's even higher. So, government debt strategy is totally confused.
So take out the part that you need for the social security of people, because obviously there are people, we don't have a social safety net. So leave that part aside for the elderly, for the vulnerable segments of society. And for the rest of the people, it needs to be market-based. Otherwise, the corporate sector can't compete with government, and they don't want to. I mean, I will make a sensible choice.
Fair point. Okay, look at our savings rate, folks. Our savings rate is low. But then Bangladesh is low too. Sri Lanka is low too. But our savings rate is much lower than India. We've got Market capitalization is much lower than India. And market capitalization... I remember I did some work on for the ADB about 1989 or something, 80, something like 1990. Market capitalization then was 20-30%. It's still there. So nothing much has happened. So let's move to the question 4. G. Muhammad Ali Ahmed Saab, Chief Strategy Officer of the EFU. Life insurance remains a very small market, right? And the aggregate insurance fund to all companies put together is very, very small. So, and also, where do you people put your investments? You people are not really, don't see you as a long-term investor in the economy, right? Your maturities, liabilities, your peak rates, etc. Everything is, I don't know how this industry works. Let me put it this way. The question is right there, but I don't know how this industry works. Could you please elaborate on us on this and tell us what is the life insurance industry or the insurance industry doing in this market? It remains very small from what I can see. It is not a large player in anything in the economy, or am I wrong? Go ahead.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Thank you, Nadeem Saab, for having me. Thank you, Naseem Beg Saab, as well. I have a few slides because when I got the...
Go ahead. I'll get out. Absolutely.
Gigi, can you see my slides now? They're on the screen.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Mansoor Saab, if you could go to the next slide. Mm-hmm. So when I received the questions, I was pleasantly surprised because I think those multiple questions give me an opportunity to perhaps share with all the participants and the speakers in terms of what life insurance industry is doing in Pakistan. And I believe it remains something like a dark horse. Not many people know about it. And Nadeem Saab, you also said that you don't know much about the industry and what we really do. So in the next 5-6 minutes, I'll try and summarize what we have been doing. Now, in terms of the capital markets, life insurance companies worldwide, life insurance and pension funds, they are one of the largest players in the capital market. And I've just picked up the world's 5 largest entities, and you can see the size of their assets. And predominantly, these are invested in the capital markets. You know, figures running into trillions of US dollar. And these entities, they have a global presence. So obviously, they are exposed to the capital markets of multiple countries, not just one country. So this will just give you an idea in terms of how large some of these global life insurance players are. What we really sell in Pakistan and all around the world, our focus is predominantly on retail customers, where we want to tap into the small and medium savers, but at the same time, we want to tap into the high net worth individuals as well. And what we offer are medium to long-term savings and insurance products. Now, when we say medium to long-term, what we really mean is medium could be something like 7 to 10 years in the insurance business, and long-term could be products which actually live with the individual throughout his or her life, right up to retirement and beyond. So our relationship with the customers and our clients is a lifelong relationship, and that's what we really offer in terms of savings as well as the insurance protection. Corporates are also one of our larger clients, where we offer pure protection products to corporate entities, which is basically called group life insurance. Large groups are insured under one master contract, and this is usually given by companies as a addition to the remuneration package. That insurance cover will also be provided if you are employed with that entity. What we also focus on is need-based solutions. So one product doesn't fit everyone. So the need analysis is done of individuals, whether they need insurance for retirement purposes. Pension is one of the significant areas where insurance companies have products. Is a product needed for future education of children? So then it is structured in a very different way. Is it a generic savings product, or is it linked to a mortgage that you want to protect? Or is it just pure insurance need, where in case of the eventuality happening, which is for life insurance, it's death or disability or health related, then the payout happens. So the insurance products we have, they have the investment element, which is quite significant. But at the same time, our core expertise and our core value addition is the pure insurance benefit that we offer. Next slide, please. So if you look at the Pakistani life insurance market, Nadeem Saab, as you said, it's a small industry. We only have 8 players in the life insurance industry. Our gross premium income, our top line in 2019 was 225 billion. The last five-year annualized growth has been 15% per annum. We've had years where we've had a growth of 35%, but the last two, 3 years have not really been great for the insurance industry. But overall, it's about 15% on a five-year average basis. This next figure, this insurance penetration, which is basically a figure which is insurance premium versus the GDP of a country, Pakistan stands probably at number three from the bottom right now in terms of global statistics. We are only at 0.5%. I probably should have put other countries as well, but I can share with you, India is about 3%, Malaysia is about 5%, and then your more developed markets, the European market and the US market, is as high as 10% and 15%. So Bangladesh is another one which is about 0.6%. So we are even lower than Bangladesh in terms of our insurance penetration. And this number has been at this 0.5%, 0.4-0.5% for the last decade, at least, as long as I've been following this number. And multiple reasons. I'll try and cover those as well. But I think this is an area where our regulator, the SECP, is working with us to try and see if what is the exact issue. Is it our distribution channels? Maybe we don't have such robust and such deep distribution channels to reach out to every individual. Is it the lack of awareness? Is religion a factor? Do people actually not buy insurance just because of religious reasons? But then we have Islamic insurance, we have the Takaful products available in the market. Or is it affordability, or are the products too complex? These are all the questions that we as the insurance industry also think about on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I think our conclusion is that lack of awareness is one issue. But I think the distribution channels also need to be further expanded so that we can reach out to all parts of the country, which at the moment is probably not really happening. There was a discussion, I think Sultan Sa from Al Falah, he mentioned about bank insurance. And that is one of the reasons for growth. Banks have really helped the insurance industry in terms of giving access to thousands of bank branches through which we can sell our products. In terms of number of customers, now, this is a number which, unfortunately, in Pakistan, not even our regulator to this extent, they don't compile and publish this. So as an insurance industry, we don't really know how many people in Pakistan have an insurance policy or are insured. Our estimates are that the retail side, which are individual insurance policies, is anywhere between 5 to 7 million individuals, and when you go to the corporate side, it's anywhere between 15 to 20 million. But these are all estimates. The numbers could have a large variance as well. But still, even if these numbers are taken as they are, given the size of the country and given that we are a younger, we have about 50% of the population under the age of 30 years or 25 years. So the potential for insurance solutions and long-term financial planning solutions is significantly there. And with only a 0.5% insurance penetration of GDP, we can't go below this 0.5. We can't be any worse than 0.5. The only direction we can go is beyond, is above 0.5. So next slide, please. Now, just to share with you some numbers, you probably might not have looked at this before, or they might not have been shared with you. As I said, the insurance sector is not very prominent, or at least it is prominent in terms of its impact, but probably it's not that well known in terms of how we interact with the capital markets. And just to share with some numbers with you, these eight life insurance companies which I mentioned, the aggregate size of our life insurance fund and is 1.5 trillion rupees. And a major part of that is actually in the capital markets. Equities, it's about 200 billion investment. All these numbers are on the published statements as of December 2019. And the government securities, because debt, the major part of debt is the government securities, it's in excess of 1 trillion rupees. So this just might give you an idea. Obviously, once you compare it to the asset management industry, we probably might still be small as compared to the total asset management industry taken together. But still, I think 1.5 trillion or let's say 1.2 trillion, which is in the capital markets, is I think a sizable exposure that we have. Government securities, you know, short term is where we park our money. But then 3-year, 5-year, 10-year PIBs is something that we also take exposure to. Beyond 10 years, only State Life Insurance Corporation, the public sector entity, they are the only ones who have an exposure to longer than 10-year bonds. And in the next slide, I will talk about when I talk about asset liability matching, I will talk about why they go into 20-year bonds and why doesn't the private sector go into such long-term bonds. Government sukuks, there are not many issues, but since all of us have a Islamic window operation as well, so the avenues, we are always hungry for investment avenues for our takaful line of business. The insurance law, the insurance ordinance which governs our business, and the insurance rules 2017, they actually have a they define the class of investments, and they define limits which apply on us as a life insurance company and also for non-life insurance companies. And they say that if we are within those limits, the assets can be used for solvency determination. But if we go beyond the limits, then the admissibility of assets applies. So the limits actually apply in terms of per script limit. Exposure to a certain group of companies, it applies to immovable property, it applies to shares of listed companies, non-listed companies, it applies to REITs as well, term finance certificates. So there's a whole long list where we are required to abide by those percentages. And if a class of investment is not mentioned there, then we really can't go and invest in that particular class of investment. So there was one question regarding mortgage financing, whether life insurance companies would like to come into long-term instruments of, let's say, mortgage-backed security. So at the moment, the insurance laws actually don't cover that as a class of investment. And also, if you could go to the next slide, please. Yes, the ALM is one thing which I wanted, which was also a question. I think this is something very important for the insurance industry, given that we have long-term liabilities. As I mentioned, our medium to long-term could range anything beyond 10 years to 40 years in terms of the products that we are offering to our customers. So it is basically dependent on the product structure, whether we are offering investment guarantees in the product and contingent liability payout pattern. All of that determines if the insurance company actually needs to focus on ALM. So just to sort of describe, we have two types of companies, life insurance companies in Pakistan. So State Life Insurance, which has been there for the last 30, 35 years, what they sell is what we call with-profit products. And simply put, the investment risk is borne by the insurance company, and there are some investment guarantees present in the product. And the liabilities are also guaranteed. So effectively, asset liability matching applies quite significantly on State Life. And that's one of the reasons why they go into long-term bonds, something like a 20-year bond, because they want to match the 20-year liability and the 20-year guarantees that they've offered into their products. So that's why State Life, an entity like State Life, would go into a 20-year bond. But the other side or the other group of companies and products are what we call unit-linked companies, a concept very similar to mutual funds, where an investment fund is offered to our customers, but the investment risk is passed on to the customer. So the insurance company does not take the investment risk. So all the private sector companies in Pakistan, which would, leaving aside State Life, the remaining seven companies, predominantly are unit-linked companies. And the products we offer actually do not offer an investment guarantee. Therefore, asset liability matching doesn't really matter for us, because what we tend to go for is we want to lock in the highest yields on bonds and optimize our equity portfolio performance and give the best return we can on our unit-linked fund, because the products predominantly have a significant investment component. People come to us because they want to save for 5 years or 10 years or long-term, and they want to get the best returns. And since we are not taking the investment risk, so then this is the investment strategy that we would be following, which is, I would say, different from what State Life would be following, because for them, it's more important to match the long-term liabilities. So this, I thought, just might give you more insight into the asset liability matching part. Next slide, please. So just to sort of summarize everything, you know, we've had a 15% top line growth for the last 5 years, but I think very similar to all other industries, banking and asset management and you know, manufacturing industry and all other industries, COVID-19 actually has really got us to rethink in terms of how the future would look like for the life insurance sector. And right now, the areas we are focusing on for this year, and especially I think this will carry forward into the next year as well, is the sustainability of our distribution channels, because selling life insurance, we actually sell it in a very expensive way. We sell it through people on the street, feet on the street, and this is an expensive way of selling insurance. And that is why one of the, I would say, anomalies we have is what we call a new business strain. So every new policy we sell actually brings a loss on our books, at least for the first 1 or 2 years. And that is why it is needed for us, for customers to stay with us, to be loyal to us, to continue their insurance policies with us for at least 7 to 10 years. That is when we actually start making profit from our product. So this is an area that all, I think the whole insurance industry is looking at in terms of how we can cut the cost of distribution channels, but at the same time, still be able to penetrate into all parts of the country. Automation and remote operations is very much our priority, and we are investing, at least EFU Life had been investing in it for the last many years, and I think this is going to be a area of focus for the next few years as well. Then we are also evaluating our products, the insurance element versus the investments element. Is this a good time to encourage people to actually get insurance cover and maybe not focus too much on investments, or should we still continue to have a balanced approach, have a reasonable amount of investment savings element, but also at the same time encourage people to actually get adequate insurance protection so that in case of death or disability, their families actually do have an income to actually support them. We are also very actively this year, given the way the stock market has performed and the levels it had gone to, and still the valuations appear to be attractive in certain sectors. So, and alongside the way the interest rates have really come down, we are obviously looking at how to balance out our portfolio of the debt side and the equity side. And I think that is something that throughout this year we will continue to focus on. And I think lastly, something that has always been a pain point for us is the lack of customer awareness and education, and using various means, digital means, social media, and our orthodox means as well, we are going to continue focusing on this particular area as well. So I think it's going to be a challenging time for the life insurance industry, but I still believe that we will continue to be a significant participant of the capital markets, given our size and given that we have a significant renewal premium every year coming in from our existing customers. So I think the numbers I showed to you, even if there is contraction that might happen in this year and next year, but the next 3 to 5 years, I feel that the life insurance sector will continue to be a significant player of the capital markets. So this is all from my side. Thank you very much.
Nadeem, you are muted.
Nadeem Saab, your mic is muted.
Sorry. One quick follow-up, Ahmed Saab. I always get the impression, I mean, maybe this is just me, but the impression that I get from the market and people around me are, insurance industry seems to be, we think of it as not a dynamic sector. We think of it mainly as a kind of industry that's just there, but it's not really competing. It's not really coming out with new products. It's not really interesting the consumer. Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, what's how do you see it?
I think you're partially right, but I think there are areas. If you look at the 2000s, from 2002 to 2010, that was a period of we were basically invisible in terms of the industry as a whole. But the last 10 years, I think we've really come out in terms of new products, new types of insurance coverages. We've come out in terms of distribution channels. Bank assurance was something that we actually did not focus on, but the last 10 years, bank assurance actually has been a significant player in terms of giving us growth. So I believe that the last 10 years, the insurance industry has come in the limelight. We are more visible in terms of our awareness efforts as well. The insurance penetration rate in the last 10 years has slightly moved from 0.4 or 0.35 to 0.5%. So we look at it in a positive way that we've been able to at least make a slight impact, slight positive impact in terms of penetration. We have in the last 10 years been able to insure about 5 to 6 million new lives who have come under our insurance safety net. So I think we've made efforts, but as I said in the beginning, I think there is still a lot to do. There's still a lot for us to be more visible. We want to be, in terms of an individual's top three financial priorities, which we are not right now. And I think collectively the industry has to make that effort in terms of being more visible and being more, I would say, relevant to an individual's financial planning needs.
Shouldn't that be through new product design? Do you have any new products coming up? Any innovative products that we can all look at?
Yes, as I mentioned my slides, we have an investment component. So we are looking at whether we can offer investment guarantees, something that the unit-linked companies have not offered up to now, but the way the interest rate environment has moved, the way the interest rates have come down, we have a lot of clients asking us that, can you offer a product with some kind of an investment guarantee? In addition to that, the types of insurance covers we offer, usually it was a payout in case of death or disability, let's say, of an individual. But very recently, what we call living benefits is something that has also been under the limelight, where people want health-related benefits. They want lifestyle-related benefits, and they want insurance to actually merge with their lifestyle. So if someone is living a healthy life, they actually would want some kind of insurance protection along with that, and insurance to actually complement their healthy lifestyle. So this is something new that we are working on, trying to bring in the fitter, part of the customer base, trying to get them to benefit more out of insurance versus a normal individual who, let's say, doesn't exercise, for example. So these are some of the areas where we are trying to innovate. Also, I think something that was never done in Pakistan until 5 years ago was to actually look at alternative ways of reaching out to customers. And one significant platform is the telcos, effectively. With the significantly high insurance density, the significantly high mobile penetration in Pakistan, the insurance sector is working very closely with the telcos, all the mobile phone operators, to actually reach out to their customers by offering very simple, small amounts of insurance cover, which can be paid by through their airtime, something that was unheard of 5 years ago. So we don't ask them to pay money to us for insurance premium. We say, if you have airtime, we can deduct your airtime, and that can be used as a currency. And just by doing that, we have a few million lives that we have been able to bring into the insurance net. So these are just some of the few things which the last 5 to 10 years have happened in the insurance sector. Along with more awareness, you might have seen more television ads of the insurance companies, more innovative ways of reaching out with the message of insurance. Okay. And digital means is something else we have done. Yes, these are areas we are actively exploring right now.
Okay. Thank you. Habibur Rahman Saab, Director, Atlas Asset Management. This issue of voluntary pension scheme, again, has been there for many, many decades now, and it still hasn't gone anywhere. I don't think there are many companies, but it's also tied into the fact that our corporates are so small. So how can you work with those people? They have, they really don't have that much of a labor force or the size. But can this how can this industry grow, and can it grow without the government? Unfortunately, I think the biggest problem is the government pension scheme is still so antiquated, unfunded, and with the huge government liabilities sitting out there, which will haunt us someday. So please give us your thoughts on the pension industry. How can the pension industry take off? Ahmad Ahmed Saab? Sorry, Habibur Rahman Saab.
I can't see Habib. He was there. Let me just call him and check.
Sure. Okay, let me move to the next question.
Then. We can go to the next.
Sure. Okay, Jee, trends in savings are there in front of you again. So let's get back to savings. And let's talk to Amjad Wahid Saab, mutual funds CEO for National Bank. There's a mutual fund industry also, like insurance, remains very small. And the number of investors is very small, especially when you compare it to other countries. Also, I don't even understand how the mutual fund industry operates when we've got a very shallow equity market, when an equity market leads to no price discovery, no M&E, no real liquidity. So tell me, is this industry a legitimate industry, and how do you expect it to grow when the underlying mutual fund is obviously a higher level industry? The underlying industry is the stock market. But if the stock market doesn't evolve, how does the mutual fund industry evolve? And how should the small saver look at the mutual fund industry? Dr. Amjad Wahid, please. Yeah, Amjad Saab, D. Tell you.
Amjad Saab, kindly have the mic and mute, Karlan, sir.
Yeah, so if we can kindly move on to the next page, capital markets and mutual funds, you know, they are sort of linked together. And again, you know, we have talked about the low savings rate, the low investment rate. If you look at stock market capitalization as a percent of GDP, 25% in Pakistan versus 76% in India. If you look at the debt to GDP ratio, 31% in Pakistan. So again, lower as compared to other countries. If you look at mutual fund assets as a percent of GDP, they're only 2%. Versus 14% in India and other countries. Then pension funds, again, only 0.1% in Pakistan, you know, the lowest, you know, just anywhere. So just move on to the next slide. So the key reason, the key impediments, in my view, in terms of growth of capital markets and mutual funds, three. First, obviously, the economic, political, and business risk of the country. You know, I think we're all aware of that, obviously. I was looking at one indicator of World Bank, which basically is in terms of political uncertainty and volatility. And out of the 149 countries I looked at, you know, the top 149 countries in the world, we were ranked sixth, you know, from the bottom. So in terms of, you know, political uncertainties, you know, inconsistency in government policies, all of that impacts the stock market. You know, Pakistani stock market is extremely volatile. And investors do not like risk. So I think this is sort of, I'll not go too much into this because you're all aware of, you know, this one. The second factor that is basically, and it's more traditional, I think in the last couple of years, there has been a lot of improvement. This is micromanagement rather than promotion of capital markets by SECP. You know, the regulator, their task is to promoting the capital markets, including mutual funds, insurance, and everything, bond, stock market. And also, obviously, regulating. I think they've forgotten historically about the promotion part. I think the rules and regulations have been so cumbersome that it became impossible for the you know, industry to grow. I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, when REITs came in, I remember like about 10 years ago or so, the REITs regulation came in. Now, before they came in, Salman Sheikh was the chairman of SECP at that time, and myself and some, you know, other CEOs from mutual funds, we went and we gave him a couple of hours of presentation of how REITs work worldwide, and, you know, what are the regulations, and, you know, what type of management fee they charge, you know, or incentives they charge when they, you know, manage REITs and so on. When the regulations came, I know there was a big function in Karachi. I attended that. Salman Shah was the finance minister at that time, interim finance minister. And I sort of knew him. So I went to him and told him that, you know, well, you know, you are inaugurating these REITs regulations. I can tell you that no REIT is going to come based on these regulations. They are extremely cumbersome. The, you know, they're, you know, the benefit or the or the management fee that you know REIT companies are going to get is only 1%. Who's going to take the trouble of launching a REIT scheme, you know, to earn 1% return? So he called in Salman Sheikh, who was at that time chairman SECP, and said, "Bhaiya, Dr. Amjit to keh rahe hain ki ye nahi chalenge." So he said, "Bhaiya, I'm aware of the, you know, of the points that Dr. Amjit has raised, and we're going to address them." 3-6 months down the road, Salman Shah was gone and Salman Sheikh was gone. Aur 10 saal tak koi REIT nahi aaya. You know, even today, I think there's only one REIT, which is RFOB REIT. But this came more of an over, you know, it did not come purely as a REIT because it came as an afterthought. Yeah. It was launched as a real estate scheme and then, you know, down the road converted into a REIT. So even today, you know, no single REIT. And I think if regulations were conducive and the management fee or incentive was good, probably we would have, you know, over a trillion or 2 trillion of REITs today in the market. One more example I'll basically give. Now, by the way, I'll just mention that the last couple of years, you know, REIT regulations have been revised. And I think now they're at a standard where we will be able to attract people to come into REITs. There have been significant changes in the regulations, the incentive structure for people, you know, who come into REIT and so on. Similarly, I think a recent development is the infrastructure funds have come in. The regulations for infrastructure funds have come in. And I must say they are excellent. I went through this draft regulations of infrastructure funds, and I found them very, investor-friendly, industry-friendly. And I hope that, you know, basically, infrastructure funds start coming in based on these good regulations. So regulations make a big difference in terms of the mutual fund industry. One of the reasons it did not go traditionally was in terms of management fee, you know, how much to charge the investor. It was so restrictive that it was not feasible for us to open branches. So, I mean, even today, mutual funds have less than 100 branches, you know, even a small bank has, you know, a lot more branches than the entire mutual fund industry. Now, the last couple of years, again, I think I must say the present commission, I think this is the most professional commissioners, you know, including the chairman that I've seen in the last 2-3 decades. And even in terms of the policy board, a very professional board. So we have seen changes where they have allowed us now relax, you know, some sort of a relaxation in terms of how much, you know, pricing we can do. And actually, you know, the best determinant of pricing is, you know, competition rather than the regulator determining the prices. Hopefully we are now moving towards in that direction. And the third part basically, which I think has been a key element in the growth of capital markets is the national savings schemes. If you can move on to the next slide. So if you look at these schemes, you know, these schemes are safe schemes. You know, there is no risk in these schemes. So I've compared them with the returns that are offered by AAA rated banks, because government is also AAA rated. And what we see is that, you know, these schemes are actually linked, you know, to the bonds, PIBs. And this is where the issue is. You know, bond is a risky instrument. And so linking, you know, the return on a risk-free instrument with a risky instrument, obviously it does not, it's comparing apples and oranges. So the basic concept, I think, if I just sort of have to say one sentence, the reason that capital markets have not grown, because the basic foundation of investments, which is low risk, low return, risk, high return, it has been violated by the national savings schemes. They are the safest scheme and they offer higher return, you know, than a lot of you know, banks, bonds, mutual funds. So being the safest, they should be offering the lowest return, but they offer the highest return, and their return should not be linked to the bond, because bond is a risky instrument. And investors are quite rational. So if you can earn about the same return risk-free, why would you take the risk of a bond? So the single most reason why the bond market has not developed in Pakistan, especially the corporate bond market, is because people go towards saving schemes where they get almost the same return as the government bonds without taking any risk. And that's why, as I think Nas mentioned, there are 7 million investors in national savings schemes, and there are only 300,000 investors in mutual funds and another 300,000 or so in the stock market. So if you're getting such high returns risk-free from the government, why would you invest in the stock market? Why would you invest in the bond market? Why would you invest in mutual funds? And the other, the result of this is that the company's borrowing rate go up. If the government is going to offer such high rates, the governments have to, the corporates have to offer an even higher rate to attract investors, which is not feasible for corporates. Let's move on to the next slide. Again, one more factor is if you look at these schemes, for example, special certificate is a 3-year scheme, but there's no penalty after 6 months. So the return on the product is that linked to a 3-year bond, whereas it's a 6-month product, because if after 6 months the investor goes out, there's no penalty. Same thing with other schemes. So what the government has done is that it has passed the entire interest rate risk to itself. And I'll just give you one example. Last year when interest rate had gone up by about 6%, over a certain period, if there were 3.3 trillion of PIBs. And what was the impact on the government of this increase in interest rate by about 6%? Nothing, because these are obviously fixed coupon schemes and the coupon rate does not move with interest rates. So the government had no impact on its own books, on the PIBs, because the entire risk was borne by the bond investors. In case of about 3.3 trillion of national savings schemes, the interest rate on these schemes went up by 110 billion per year, because obviously investors got out, by paying very little penalty, or because the maturity was only like 6 months, and then invested at a higher rate. And some of these schemes automatically, when the rate goes up, the rate on the scheme goes up. But when the rates go down, obviously these NSS holders are locked in and they earn the high rate. I mean, a lot of these investors, including institutions, lock themselves in NSS at 13%, 14%. And now interest rates are down to, 7, 8%. And as a result, all of this interest rate risk has been borne by the government. So this is a big anomaly. I'll just move on to the next slide. CDNS, Central Deposit Directorate of National Savings, which launched these schemes, they launched 3, 5, 10-year bonds and they failed. CDNS has been able to raise about 4 trillion in these different schemes, but when they try to raise money in bonds, only 3.6 billion came in, and that also faded after a few months, because obviously investors are rational. If they're getting the same return risk-free on other schemes, why would they go and buy bonds even launched by the government or by CDNS? So again, showing that the key reason why the bond market is not developing or has not developed in Pakistan is the very high rate offered by these schemes. Yeah, just move on to the next scheme. Next slide, sorry. So we talked about the drawbacks. State Bank's own wording, more net flow toward NSS limits the bank ability to finance investments in medium-term projects. It crowds out the private sector by government borrowing at high rates. It hinders growth of the mutual fund industry, bond market, stock market, banking industry. The debt capital market scheme, which was basically formed by SPP, basically stated that historically NSS has been a costly source of funding for the government due to inefficient pricing structure and the free embedded put option. The built-in option allows investors to redeem investment at any time. So same conclusion, but again, as Nas said, this presentation I've been giving for the last 15 years, nothing has happened. So I'm not too hopeful, but this is a key impediment. Let's move on to the next slide. So in terms of recommendations, there are similar schemes in India and Bangladesh, but A, only individuals can invest. B, the limits are small. In India, a scheme similar to Bebud is limited to 1.5 million rupees. in Pakistan, it's 5 million rupees. So if it is a couple, it goes to 10 million. If it's a government official, it goes to, you know, it doubles. And basically, you know, what I don't understand, we say, yeah, you know, we are actually helping out the retired people. I'm retired, I'm worth 100 million rupees, or I'm, let's say I'm worth, you know, 500 million rupees. Do I need a subsidy from the government? You know, how many retired people, poor retired people, have 5 million in cash? I want to know. I mean, 30%, 40% of Pakistani population, when they retire, they don't even have probably 500,000 in cash. So actually, in these schemes, the government is subsidizing the richest elite of the country. I think if some subsidy has to be given, it has to be targeted, like a SAS program. I mean, giving out subsidies just because I'm retired, I don't think I deserve a subsidy, especially if I'm worth 100 million or 50 million or whatever. So I think that there's a need that the government should set up an NSS pricing committee, constituting economists, retired bankers, academia, etc., who should meet on a regular basis, just like the monetary committee of SPP meets. And then they should decide what the rates on this NSS scheme should be. They should also look at the penalty structure, and they should also look at the tax structure, because there are tax benefits on these schemes. There are very low penalties, and the rates are phenomenally high. And that's why we have 7 million investors in NSS and very little in the bond market, the stock market, or mutual funds. Is this the last slide? Can you think so? I'll just skip that in the interest of time. I'll stop here.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Habib Saab is back. Habib okay. Rahman is back.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you. Acha ji, but I have a follow-up question on that. Habib Saab, follow-up question. Thoda sa main kar lunga. I think, quite frankly, we have to be a little bit careful. I think we are trying to fix somebody else's market. Why is your market not offering a competitive return? I think risk-free markets, so Harjagot, the US savings bond market, which is higher than the other markets. Savings bond markets, so Harjagot, and that's not a big deal. The issue is that if the inefficient market should be able to offer higher returns than the NSS scheme. So I'm not sure whether the NSS scheme is the full culprit. Go ahead, G, please. If you can quickly answer that, we'll move on to the next one.
It's very simple. As an investor, the rationale. If I'm getting a scheme which is the lowest risk, obviously government is sovereign, it has the lowest risk, and it offers a very high return at the expense of the taxpayers. Where does this money come from? If CDNS were an independent institution, it would have gone bankrupt a long time ago. So basically, this institution is funded by taxpayers. And my mutual fund, I'm sorry, nobody, you know, subsidizes or funds my taxpayer, my mutual industry. So basically, if the government is willing to give phenomenal returns, then obviously investors are smart enough to go where there are high returns and low risk. You know, I don't think, anybody can match that, because this is all at the expense of the taxpayers.
Okay, ji, theek hai. Habib Saab, are you back now? Were we at the next question? Sorry. Habib Saab had gone.
Habib Saab needs to unmute.
Achha, theek hai. Habib Saab, the question is here for you on voluntary pension schemes. And, why are you so small? And I wanted to link two things to it. Is it because the corporates are very small? And is it because the government doesn't reform its pension scheme? If the government reforms its pension scheme and gets out of unfunded pension and uses the markets, then you could grow. But tell me, how can you make your market grow? Habib Saab, floor is yours.
He is not, he's muted still.
Habib Saab, unmute kar lein. Mansoor Saab, can you unmute Habib Saab, or has he got to do it himself?
Sir, screen pe ek bar appear ho rahi hai, wahan pe mute ka sign hai, left side is second. Habib Saab, kindly us pe click kar dein.
Ye maine click kar diya. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir, we can hear you, sir.
Fine, bataiye.
First of all, thank you, Nadeem Saab, for having me in this webinar. I'm really grateful to you. The question which has been put up to me is, why has VPS not defied so many tax advantages. I will try to explain it to you, but you know, even after 12 years of its existence, VPS is not very much known. People still ask, what is a VPS? So I will just like to start with, give a brief summary of what VPS is and what other retirement saving scheme were there before VPS came. Before VPS was launched, we had only occupational saving schemes like Provident Fund, which were floated by the companies and in which the employees used to participate. It was a very limited, you know, participation in the pension. Only the employees of the companies which were offering the Provident Fund. The purpose of VPS was to expand the coverage, to bring more people into the pension scheme. People who are self-employed and who did not have any access to pension scheme, and also to bring into a pension scheme people who are working abroad, Pakistani working abroad. That was the real intention behind it. The second reason for VPS was that before VPS, pension schemes to be unfunded, and particularly the government pension scheme were unfunded. The idea was that the government employees, what is called gradually, not at one all at one time, will come into this pension scheme, and at least those new entrants to the government service can to start with. And the third reason was the investment policies. Before the VPS came, the investment policies of the saving scheme were too much focused towards security. You know, they were only allowed to invest in low-yielding government securities, and over a period of time, the time value of money, they did not grow in the value. So the concept was to bring a set investment policies where the security would be there, but over a period of time, by investing in equities or REIT, the value of the investment could also rise, so that when the person retires, he gets the adequate value of the money. So as a first step towards the pension reform, Security and Exchange Act 1997 was amended to allow SECP to act as regulator and promoter. I am emphasizing both the thing regulator and promoter. Further, the voluntary pension rules were introduced in 2005, and these rules were, I'm happy to say, were drafted or by Mr. Naseem Beg. He was one of the consultant who drafting it, and VPS rule is one of the finest rule in the country. VPS is composed of three sub-funds, and through these sub-funds, the value of the value of in the real estate, and later when the person years before the from growth to security part, so you can have both initial stage and security of capital in the later stage. Now I come to the tax advantages. investing in VPS. There were three basic tax advantages. VPS is, as we call it in the our terminology, is E plus E plus E. That is, it is exempt when you invest in the VPS. The VPS income is exempt from tax, and when you get the pen, it is also exempt from the tax. So it is E. Now, coming to the credit state, the section 63 of the income tax ordinance was introduced, and this is the point which I want to emphasize, and in which it was stated that the contribution to voluntary pension scheme will be entitled to tax credit at 20% from the income which is drawn from salary and business. So those people who are employed in a company, if they invest in the VPS, they will get the tax credit. And also the businessmen who have got shops and other things, or they are doing business, they will get also the tax credit on their income from the businesses. This is what section 63 of the income tax ordinance says. But so far the salaried people are concerned, if they invest in the VPS, they get the tax credit. There's no problem in that. And they get it at the payment stage. The employer allows the tax credit and they file the return accordingly. But so far the business people are concerned, there is another section in the income tax ordinance, section 113 of the income tax ordinance, which simply says that business which has got the turnover of 10 million or above, 10 million is not a big amount, that is about 1 million per, less than 1 million per month, they will be taxed under section 113. That is that 1.5% of their turnover will be the tax liability. That will be the minimum tax liability. So if that is the way they are going to be taxed, so they are not getting any tax credit. So the purpose of the VPS when it was introduced was that the base will be increased, you know, and particularly the intention is very clear. The amendment in section 63 of the income tax ordinance to include business income as to be entitled for tax credit simply shows that. But section 63 offers is taken away section 113. So if you look at the list of participants, there are participants, and whichever company you look into it, you will find the same people, as there will not be any single or business people whose income is as a participant. So that is one of the reasons why VPS has not been able to expand. So far, the performance of the business pension fund manager is concerned, SECP allowed licenses to 10 asset management companies. It was open to asset management companies and life insurance companies, but none of the life insurance companies have offered themselves for registration as a pension fund manager, and only asset management companies have shown. The total size of the VPS is now 30 billion. And 90% of this AUM is raised by five pension fund managers, and the 10% by the remaining. And as I said, then most of the pension participants are self-employed, and self-employed people, they have yet to join the VPS. I think there is an urgent need to amend the income tax law, allow the tax credit irrespective of whether the person's income is assessed under 113, section 113 or whatever. So if that is done, I think it will be possible to attract business growth. The second thing that whereas SECP has done wonderful job as a regulator, the second duty which they were to perform as a promoter, they have been lacking. There is no fund assigned to for promotion of VPS. I think the pension fund managers and SECP should promote this scheme, and there is some funds should be allocated. Besides the changing the income tax law, if VPS has to take off. To summarize, we have a good set of pension rules under which the pension fund manager's performance, so far the return is concerned, is very good. However, the pension assets have not increased substantially because of the factors I have given. The other factor is when the VPS was launched, it was so many meetings took place. And I remember meeting the Chief Secretary of Punjab. I went there along with late Mr. Yusuf Shirazi, and he asked me this question that, Habib, what will be the size of the VPS AUM after 5 years? So I gave him a figure, and he said, no, I don't agree with that. It will be much larger. I asked him, sir, how you have drawn this conclusion? He said the government has unfunded schemes, and government will also participate in the VPS. You have to show performance, but that has not taken place. We had so many meetings. I think Dr. Amjad Wahid may watch me out. So these are the few things which I mentioned, that number one, promoting it. Number two, change in the income tax ordinance allowing tax credit on business income, and I think and promotion. Thank you very much.
Sir Nadeem, kindly apna mic unmute kar le. Sir Nadeem.
Nadeem, you are muted.
Sir Nadeem, kindly apna mic unmute kar le.
Am I okay now?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay.
Hey, lovely, lovely. Okay, Ji. Okay, Ji. Farooq Saab, let's go to you. Farooq Saab, let me ask you a very simple question. I seem to have lost my slides, but that doesn't matter. Farooq Saab, you, mashallah, now the CEO of PSX. Now, PSX was, combined out of three or four stock exchange companies. It is a monopoly in the country, and the Chinese have come and bought it out. But we, as investors or as retail people or whatever, we see no change in the PSX. As I read out the quote by your predecessor, the foreigner who came to run PSX, he was very unhappy and he made some very disparaging comments. Your market still remains very small. The number of listings are very small. New issues are hardly there. Number of investors, as I said, is very, very small. You have no other instruments apart from stock There's no real corporate debt market. It doesn't seem anywhere that it's going anywhere. What is the intention of the Chinese? Do they want to run a stock exchange, or do they just want to let it be sleepy? And the second important question is, Khalid Mirza said very categorically in our last webinar, we need more competition. We need SECP to issue more licenses for stock exchange. How do you react to all these things?
Thank you very much, Nadeem, and thank you for having me on this panel. It's been a really interesting discussion so far. And in many ways, a lot of what needs to be said has already been said, so I will not repeat it. I agree with most of the things that have been said. I'll just maybe, in the interest of time, say a few points and then try and answer some of the particular questions that you've asked. But to start with, let me just say that when I got the invitation and saw the title, I don't really agree with the way the title has been drafted. It is definitely a capital market. PSX's predecessor, KSE, is one of the oldest markets in Asia. And there is no question in my mind, as someone who's been involved in the market since going back to 1991, when the market first opened to international investors, that it has played an important role in the development of Pakistan. I think the question that comes to my mind and what you're also asking is it where it needs to be? And the answer to that is no. And can it play an even greater role? And the answer to that absolutely is yes. With regards to the first question, is it where it needs to be? As has been pointed out in different ways, but looking at it in a more macro manner, the market, as you know, operates in a macro environment, the economic, social and political environment. And perhaps we would all agree, as you were mentioning at the beginning and showed the slides, that Pakistan has so far, unfortunately, also not realized its full potential. So we can't really judge the market or come up with solutions to make it a larger, a more effective capital market without looking at the overall macro environment. And I think the kind of discussion we are having today, and I'm sorry, I've not been able to listen into the what seemed like very interesting webinars you held earlier. But I hope that to conclude this series of webinars, you will pull together what we have listened and learned and see, how some of these macro level issues can be addressed. Yes, we can make changes and we must make changes which are more micro, which relate, specifically to issues of, VPS or mutual funds, insurance companies, capital markets, etc. But at the same time, we have to start the long, difficult work of changing some of the macro level issues. And some of those, I will sort of quickly touch upon, how do we create an equity culture or an investment and savings culture in the country? And that goes beyond just capital. Hello?
Didi, go ahead.
Okay. If you look at countries like, if you've been to places like India, Thailand, etc., there are billboards there advertising IPOs, capital markets, which compete with, film billboards. We have never really seen the effort that needs to be made. Brokers, mutual funds, the whole ecosystem, the capital markets, needs to, in my view, make a much greater role to beat the street, to go out there and cultivate, the equity culture, to cultivate, new investors. Because it's absolutely right that even looking at retail investor, number of investors through mutual funds and insurance companies, etc., it still is a few hundred thousand, maybe 600,000 to 800,000 in all, and some of them would be double counted, but we don't really see that. Habib Saab just made a point that struck me. I mean, where you don't have the regulator allocating funds to create markets, surely it is the role of the mutual funds, the brokerage firms, the insurance companies to educate investors and to create markets. You will not have the FSA or any other regulators, trying to market And here also we have somehow, you know, this inverted concept that PSX must go and you know, create investors. Who benefits the most, who makes the most money out of new investors are mutual funds and brokers. PSX, SECP, you know, we must support and help in that effort. But the primary responsibility, you know, has to lie with the commercial organizations that are operating in these markets. Overregulation has been touched upon, and that is definitely the case. You know, I have to say, I think the SECP currently is extremely cognizant of it. Many regulations have been changed in the last couple of years, for example, for listings, all spectrum, you know, for the new GEMS board that is coming out, for smaller companies, SMEs, to the main board, to the debt markets. The regulations for listing companies have been significantly eased. But I think the overall mindset of having, you know, we have so many safeguards when in fact there is so little to guard. I don't think that we have yet got that balance right. You know, we've had the great crash in the US, you know, the most highly developed markets in the world. You cannot safeguard so much that you take away the risk of having any issues happening, because all you do is you just close everything and then nothing happens and then nothing goes wrong. I think we also touched upon the business culture, which is important because the markets, as I said, grow in a macro environment. Why are there no regional or global firms that have developed out of Pakistan over the last 70 years? You know, Vietnam, that has opened up in a market economy, you know, literally over the last 10, 15 years, but yet the entrepreneurs are already taking a regional view of how their businesses will grow. And similarly, all over Asia, let alone the developed West. And perhaps one of the reasons, which I'm sure has been touched upon in your previous seminar, is, you know, this whole idea of the rental economy, in which, you know, many, you know, of people have thrived. You know, back in the days, the textile firms were more interested in trading quotas than developing, you know, brands that could go regional and global. And one of the last points that I'd also like to touch upon before going into some, you know, touching upon what's happening is, you know, you talk about the SAIT culture, and it's spoken about, you know, in an almost sort of derogatory manner. And that's not speculation. SAIT culture is extremely important and is there in every market in the world. I mean, Reliance, one of the largest companies out of India and in Asia and globally, is also developed and run by a SAIT. So SAIT culture in itself, there's nothing wrong. And I don't think we should look down upon it. There are aspects of it. Those can happen in multinationals. We've had so many, you know, multinational, you know, financial and fiduciary issues that have come up globally. So that is, you know, a different issue. And we should not, I think, merge that, because that just feeds into the narrative that you touched upon, that somehow profit is bad. I think we need to be cognizant of our language as well. But I would just like now to touch upon, you know, some of the changes that are taking place and some of the green shoots, which I think need to be nurtured to take the market forward as we work, and we collectively have to work on some of these macro issues. The regulations, as I said, have been simplified and are continuing to be simplified, and we must support the SECP in that. I think you know, we have a real opportunity to work with the regulator right now to make many of these changes, both at the ministry as well as at the SECP. You know, we've just now had the 200 billion sukuk issue, which is for the first time that we've had a book building debt issue happening in the market, and that's an extremely important step moving forward. As Naz was mentioning, you know, what it has done is, it's really not a question of whether retail investors come in or not come in. It is a question of using the market and using the competitive process of the market. You know, we've seen that the sukuk issue that was done as a syndicate deal, you know, the price that the government was able to get was almost, you know, 80-90 basis points less. Now, that's a huge transfer of wealth from the corporate sector will also take cognizance of that, because they then, you know, book building is the way it's done globally. And I hope this benchmark issue will set a trend for more debt issues to come to the market, because that's the only way banks will get disintermediated. Banks, there's no reason for banks to disintermediate themselves. The GEMS market is going to be, I don't think it's going to be easy to start, but if we are launching it, it's actually in place. There is some interest, but we've held off the formal launch because of the COVID crisis. So that's another green shoot, I think, that we need to nurture. The development of the mutual fund and life assurance industries, you know, that's how majority of the retail investors all over the world access the capital markets. It's actually perhaps not even advisable for small investors to come and try and fund directly in the market. And, you know, the market can't grow. It's a virtuous cycle. The mutual fund industry, the life assurance, insurance industries, pension fund industries, you know, they all have to grow together. And, you know, we have lagged behind. I think the industries are growing well in recent years, but there is a long way for us to go to provide these products to investors. I mean, I remember reading many years ago once that pre-nationalization, EFU Life Assurance was the largest life assurance company in Asia, you know, outside of Japan. So we have to get back to those levels. Insurance companies in recent months have been the largest buyers in the market, because they again, you know, have the ability to take a long-term view in the market. And we need players like those to give that stability and a long-term outlook to the market. We've recently, you know, there have been no new products, and that's a fair criticism of PSX for almost a decade. We have recently launched ETFs in a very difficult environment, but we took the decision to move ahead. And I think, you know, that is a huge, you know, step forward. It will take time for it to develop. But again, I would urge, you know, the mutual fund industry has been extremely conservative in doing that. Just like the banks are afraid of cannibalization, they've been afraid of cannibalization. But I think we have to look beyond that, because someone is going to cannibalize you. You know, it's not a choice. You know, Templeton, Franklin didn't do ETFs, and look at where they are now, and look at where BlackRock is now. So trying to not go with innovation is no protection against getting cannibalized, or is in fact no way, I would say, to even run a business in today's, you know, day and age. I'll stop there now. I think a couple of, or if you want, I can address some of the questions that you answered. You know, there's been a huge, if you look at from my own personal experience, 91 to today, the markets have changed and evolved, you know, tremendously, from open outcry, book, you know, paper certificates, to completely automated trading, to, you know, deep materialized you know, scripts, to what's happened in the last 3-4 years. And that's taken a lot of attention. You had the merger of the three exchanges. Then you had the exchanges demutualized, from brokers owning the exchange to becoming a corporate entity, the listing. So all of that, you know, change takes time. It takes time for people to adjust to the new realities as they're happening. So in that sense, I'm not concerned that perhaps we have not seen as fast a movement towards progress in the last 3-4 years as we may have, because there is a lot of change management that has had to be dealt with. I think we are fortunate. The Chinese are very committed. We have, you know, three of the largest exchanges in the world as our strategic partners. And, you know, it's the most high profile Chinese private sector investment in Pakistan. And I hope that they will have, inshallah, good experience. We are at the moment finally, you know, implementing, after almost 20 years, a state of the art trading system with the Shenzhen Exchange is, you know, helping us implement. And that will, along with some of the other steps that I've highlighted, will, I hope, start creating greater trust amongst investors that PSX indeed is a transparent and effective, you know, trading platform. I'll stop there now, because I think
thank you, Farag sir, very kind, very kind. I think you've given us a lot of hope and food for thought, and I think I'm glad you are thinking very proactively. But a quick question: why or when are we going to see new issues on the market? two, should we have more competition in the stock exchange business? Should we have more exchanges? And three, I mean, really, it's a very thin market. So I don't even see what mutual funds are doing there in such a thin market. I mean, how many of your companies, you have about 500 companies listed, out of which I think 300 don't trade at all. And maybe the 200 that do trade are trade very thinly. Am I wrong on this, or how will you increase liquidity?
You're absolutely right, and that's what I said at the beginning. Many of the reasons for those, you know, have been highlighted. I think the NSS is a real issue for the entire sector, whether it's fixed income or equities. So you've asked three different questions. So the first one, listings. There are a number, or there were quite a lot of regulatory issues which hindered the listing process or disincentivized people from coming to listing. Because, you know, if you have already structured the whole project, you've run it for 3 years and you need to show a profitable track record to come and raise capital, you've already raised all the capital whichever way you wanted to. Now, why would you come and, you know, yes, you might need to, you know, need capital for some of the things. You come and do a share sale. But, you know, we need to understand that we are still a country that is in the process of industrialization. If you go back even in the 90s, you saw a company like, say, Brahim Fiber that did an all equity issue. It was a greenfield project. Now, our regulations didn't really allow greenfield projects to come in anymore. Because as I said, they created so many safeguards that there was no activity happening in essence that you needed to guard against. So many of those regulatory changes have been undone. Then the ongoing, you know, corporate governance had become extremely onerous. Again, we need to look at international best practices everywhere, but we need to adapt them to what our needs are, what our stage of development is. So I think a lot of those have been regularized or simplified. So I hope that will encourage listings to come as the economic environment settles down. Secondly, as I mentioned, you know, in the end, projects need to be happening. Companies need to be established who need capital to grow. That is the whole purpose of primary issuance. And obviously that is linked to, you know, the overall, as you saw and showed in your slides, that we are, our economic growth, instead of accelerating, is actually slowing down. And that, you know, that has an impact on, companies' need for capital to grow. But I'm quite positive that in the coming, I think, 24 months, the IPO side, both from the equity and the debt side, I think will significantly improve because of some of these efforts that are being made. And as our companies also, you know, need capital to grow and capitalize and in fact restructure, many of them will have to repair their balance sheet because of the losses that are inevitably being incurred by everyone in the world because of this COVID issue. In terms of thinly traded market, we have both a supply side issue in terms of new listings, as well as demand side issue where there is a small number of investors. And again, we've touched upon, and really the largest players in any capital market in the world are mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance companies. And all these three sectors are still very small in Pakistan. I think we need to look at our pension sector in particular, because that not only provides the saving schemes, it actually provides, you know, some of the largest investors in private equity are, and infrastructure projects are, pension funds, because they again have the 20-30 year outlook to be able to do this. And perhaps we should look at, you know, what Chile did, I think it was back in the 90s, to really reform the entire pension sector, which played a huge role in the economic development of the country at that time.
One quick question. The 2008 crisis showed that there was an important need to separate research from the brokerage business. Because if in-house research kind of fooled the customers or was used to sell products for the trading arm of the company, who does our research in Pakistan? I don't see any research companies. I see research all being done by brokers. So how can I have trust in your research? Why is research not being done independently? When I go to the PSX website or when I go to the SECP website, there is hardly any research at all. But that's in keeping with the government. So in a sense, part of the problem also is that we have this regulatory problem, huge regulatory issue where we are confounding ourselves, where we are taking one step back, but one step forward, three step backwards, and we are all kind of mess in the market. But that's possibly because of the lack of research. Are you guys doing anything about that, or is that just on the back foot? Like in our corporate sector, we also found there was no R&D. R&D seems to be something that in this country we regard as inferior good or as a useless good. Is that something that the market also thinks? Anybody, please?
Sure. So let me.
May I suggest that we have Mohammed Asim of MCB Arif Habib come in. He is the chief investment officer and does internal in-house research for investing in mutual funds. He's not had a chance to speak as yet.
Okay. Asim Saab, go ahead, please.
Asim, are you there?
Jee, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you, Nadeem Saab. And thank you, Big Saab, for inviting me here. We have already seen such learned, experienced, and speakers who have already spoken a lot about the market and the kind of efforts that are needed. Although some of the stats about the market have already been shared, so I had two aspects to talk about. One was why our markets or how our markets relate with respect to other markets in Asia. And from CFA Society, if there are any recommendations. So I'll just go about, with your permission, sharing a few slides. I'll try to be very quick because a lot has already been discussed. So I hope you can see the slides. Okay. So I'll just quickly allot, since you have already covered, Nadeem Saab, aapne bhi cover kiya tha, plus other speakers have already talked about. So just to build again the context, recap the context of when savings ratio and investment ratio. This is how it relates to several economies in Asia. And one more aspect which has not been touched very significantly here in this forum is again the penetration of banking sector, and not to mention that banking sector is one of the industries which was developed since early phases, and more importantly within until 90s in the public sector. So this is the penetration of our banking sector, where it shows the deposits per 1,000 adults, the borrowers from commercial banks, credit cards, insurance policies. And this is how we fare towards the bottom in almost all these fares, which tells you about the penetration of banking sector and the access of individuals towards the financial system. And this also probably speaks about the undocumented economy, which is also a very huge portion and one of the reasons why the investors are staying aloof from the formal system. Again, similar stats, so in terms of even deposits, in terms of credit to private sector, we fare significantly low in terms of SME loans as a percentage of GDP. And one more factor I wanted to highlight is the growing incidence of currency in circulation in the economy. As you can see, already it was high, and over the last few years, we have seen that has increased at an alarming rate, causing again more exodus from the formal system. And obviously it has implications again for our already shallow markets. And again, in terms of the capital markets, you have already covered in terms of market cap, in terms of listed companies, in terms of mutual funds, Dr. Amjad has already spoken about a lot. Corporate bond market, we already discussed, is almost non-existent. Slide I borrowed from a McKinsey study. It's a relatively old 2017, but I think still valid in terms of how our market is ranked in terms of three indicators, which also gives us, I think, a framework to think about as well. And one is how the issuers raise affordable capital at scale with how much ease. The other dimension is attractive and diverse avenues to deploy long-term and short-term savings in our capital markets. This includes, again, covers both equity and debt markets, and offer high-quality price information to ensure resource allocation. So obviously, on all three indicators, in the backdrop of economic environment, political environment, security environment we have discussed, along with the issues of overall penetration of financial system and formal financial channels, this explains somewhat context to that. I will just also quickly highlight that despite last 3 years haven't been that great in terms of markets performance, so investors who have had a long-term horizon have actually made very decent returns or very significant returns on real basis, on inflation adjusted basis. Even if you consider that investment was made near the peak levels before several crises we have seen in our history. So in terms of the recommendations, again, I think you just touched about the trust. I would like to mention that CFA Institute recently released a report and highlighted the importance of trust in the investment profession and considers it one of the most important elements to ensure the industry continues to grow, the financial interactions continue to expand, and the institutions have a long-term future. There are several indicators, several aspects of market we talked about, where we are disadvantaged either because of the economic situation, either because of the overall banking and formal channels, undocumented economy. I think investor trust is one area where we have the best of the talents, we have best of the people working there. This is one area where we can try to strive better than the rest of the markets. So there is no comparison in relation to the developed markets here. And I would like to mention that over the period, in terms of market integrity, in terms of professionalism, in terms of trust or service to investor, we have evolved, we have improved. However, a lot still needs to be done. In terms of the investor trust and confidence, I think one area where we can do still better is again in strengthening our institutions, focusing on more professionalism, ethics, and customer care. I would quickly mention one interesting and evolving thought is again just making you think in terms of how we approach our investment profession. How do doctors relate to their profession, and what is the perception of the general public when they compare between the profession? Because again, investment management, investment advice, or any part of financial system, we are providing a service as well. So again, CFA Institute, I would refer to this study where they compare the asked individuals and institutions around the globe in several markets, that how trustworthy do they consider several professions, relatively speaking. So doctors, accountants, lawyers, financial advisors, and of course, doctors were scored highest in terms of overall trust, 77% by accountants, 42%, lawyers, 29%. And financial advisors, 23%. So this is an area where, which again, this is a global study. In Pakistan's context, we still have a very shallow market, but I feel this is one area where we can do significantly better, but requires a lot of commitment and realization from the institutions. The other aspect is again, as a practitioner society, we are all fund managers or investment analysts working in the capital markets. So just very my two cents would be from the society again is we just looked at the stats with regards to formal economy and the incident and the penetration of the overall banking system, which tells you again towards the huge flourishing economy which is outside the overall public markets, but still a very thriving economy, or still has very large and very big growing institutions. and that is only existing because of probably distortions in our overall system, because we have on one side a very shallow market, which has a regulatory burden. Again, in terms of comparison, we all know that people do not want to get listed or do not want to become formal towards the formal compliance system, because again, there is no cost to it. While coming towards capital markets, there are no incentives to it. So there used to be a tax advantage for the public listed companies, which was withdrawn. Now consider any corporate investor or corporate institution, why would it consider to come towards financial markets? When there is a compliance burden, there is a compliance cost, there is a reporting cost, and again, without any tangible benefit to incentivize listing. So that is very important for our capital market development. Farooq Saab also mentioned, you also mentioned about the pension funds. I will quickly mention about, I think close to 500 billion is the cost of superannuation and pensions that government is budgeting or is keeping the amount in the overall fiscal budget.
It's a huge amount. Sir, we have lost your screen, sir. Kindly share your presentation.
Gee, there is no presentation. I'll just quickly mention these points for you.
Theek hai ji, kare.
So this pension sector needs to be taken again. Farooq Saab also mentioned that long-term institutions are, and anchor institutions are very important to develop any market, whether it's equity, debt market, or overall market. Thirdly, I think in terms of overall broader participation, we all have to contribute. Plus, government also has to take it seriously in terms of promoting financial saving. Generally, there is no financial planning. There is no retirement planning, except for the very small corporate sector. A large portion of our people are not in terms of saving, in terms of their financial planning, or care about even their financial planning. So these are the few distortions. And second, very quickly, I would like to mention about the market structure as well. We haven't seen any significant change in our market for the last 15 years. In terms of index heavyweight sectors, we still have energy chain, where a lot is evolving in terms of the new developments, in terms of new technologies. Oil, we have just seen, but we still have energy chain, which is the largest sector. Secondly, just quickly mentioned that I think in S&P 500, about 50% of now the index composition has moved to, is related to technology, telecommunication, education, healthcare. So these are the sectors. That's how the markets have evolved. While our market, because of lack of fuel of fresh listings, has been largely deprived of these developments. While our economy has does improve, we have seen huge retail chains coming up, MNCs growing significantly, education sector, and several other sectors which are still outside the market, but our economy has changed, but the market hasn't changed. And thirdly, again, very quickly mentioned about Farooq Saab mentioned about the new products. I think derivatives and options would be a way where we can encourage broader market and increase the market depth. So I'll just stop here. Just wanted to quickly share these thoughts. Thank you.
If you could just answer one question on research. Don't you do research-based investing? Because Nadeem Saab was saying there's no independent research.
Gee, I'll say not just us. In fact, the all the asset managers do research. We also research and we write to investors.
Companies, I would say.
And insurance companies, and we write to our investors as well. We share detailed notes, especially when the COVID situation started to evolve and when we reached at a particular stage. We compared again the markets, shared our impact on the earnings, and everything has been shared. But yes, I think because we serve to our investors, we have not been that open to public in terms of sharing that information. But that is something we can consider. As
I think the issue that came out in the 2008 crisis was that in-house research was beholden to the commercial or the profit margin of the company. So the in-house research ended up fooling customers into taking positions, like Goldman Sachs, for example, forced all its customers to take positions in CDOs while they themselves were not taking positions on their books. They were in fact shorting CDOs. So that issue came up that the market research, in-house research, can be a advertisement arm of the company rather than a research wing. So one of the things that Dodd-Frank, et cetera, put up is that there must be independent research to guide the customer. And a lot of emphasis has been placed now on independent research. But we leave that as it is, because I think we should move to the audience.
Sir, sorry, I would like to add here, because although I'm not a stockbroker, a capital market participant, I would like to add that even in the financial crisis, the research that was available, I think it was independent. It was reflecting the economic circumstances. It's just the rate of acceleration at which the things deteriorated, which could not be captured again in research and had to be reactive. So that's I think true for the global markets as well. If you look at the research available, so there were very few who could have called down on the markets in terms of circumstances and everything. But largely speaking, as a consumer of research myself, being an asset manager, I feel that over the period, yes, the quality has deteriorated and again has a bearing on the size of the markets, because the volumes have been low, the brokerage houses have shrunk. However, in terms of generally, I have seen that the professionalism, the independence has been there. Yes, the quality needs to be there.
Okay, great.
And also, Nadeem, if I could just add, again, looking at international scenarios, I mean, the crisis in 2008 in Pakistan was very different to what was happening in the international market. And the reasons for it were very, very different and very peculiar to our own market. And actually, for Pakistan, the issue of research or independent research really had no role to play in that particular crisis. That's a separate issue, but for crisis, mein wo issue nahi tha. So we shouldn't pick up, you know, what happened in international markets and without looking at the local context, try and implement something or come to a conclusion.
Fair point. Okay, let me turn to the audience, because I think everybody is raring to go. But let me just say simply that, I mean, for example, our stock exchange has no retail chain, no construction industry, no service industry. I mean, I see so many gaps missing that this is something that we should also talk about. But we'll do that later. So can I just call on Mr. Sameer Ahmed? Sameer Ahmed? Sameer, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my question and observation is really, what's the consumer offering from the point of view of the customer, the retail customer? What is the value added? And this is a question that I'd like all of the industries to consider, whether it's mutual funds, whether it's life insurance. I'll just give you one example. I have a unit link policy, and as Muhammad Ali mentioned earlier, the life insurance companies' costs are so high that, you know, if I die, great, my family gets the money, but if I live through that policy, my investment returns are minuscule. So from an investment point of view, that life insurance is really not making much sense. But that's a general observation, Kay. I think all of the industry needs to think about the value add to the consumer really.
G, next person, I think Mr. Idris Khaja. I'll collect some questions and come back to you. Mr. Idris Khaja? Idris, are you there? Okay, Muhammad Sohail?
How are you? Thank you very much, Nitin Saab.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Idris is here. Okay, go ahead, Idris. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Idris. Idris Khaja.
Yes, Idris Khaja here. I think thinness of the market is related to the literacy rate. What other countries with our kind of literacy rate have a developed capital markets. So if there is kind of literacy rate that we have, then there is role of the mediators like brokers and like mutual funds, etc. So if somehow the brokers and mutual funds can build a trust in the market and show that they can pay returns to the investors, then probably the market can grow. And probably what, as you talked of research, probably what the markets, asset managers, etc. can do is that they can show to the market, as just as the schools do, that look, so many people enrolled with us and they have graduated and so many secured A grades and so on and so forth. If the brokers can tell the market that we have paid returns to investors, so many invested in this year and they have reaped returns, then probably the market can grow. And if they can again tell that most of the return in market is related to the capital gain. If there can be more return of the dividend, which is rather regular return as relative to capital gain, which is more speculative, then again, probably the market can grow. As far as the debt market is concerned, it is, there has to be institutional support, because the debt investor is most more concerned about the return of his principal amount in the first place. But if the debt investor is unsure that if the bond goes into default and the litigation process can take ages, then probably, again, he would be shy of investing. So these institutions need to be addressed. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll come to the panel after I collect a few questions. So Mohammed Suhail Saab.
Yeah, thank you very much, Nadeem Saab. I just have three small questions or observation. One is, I think that one of the reasons for lack of development of equity market in Pakistan over the last, say, 20 years has been, which nobody has talked about, a big trust deficit between the exchanges or brokers and SECP. So I think till the demutualization, this trust was logical because there has been incidents. But I think after this Chinese takeover, the trust deficit is still there, maybe lesser, but still there. So this is one of the major block when the regulator and the regulatee are not on the same terms, how can a market will develop, number one. Number two, we were just talking about the number of investors, which are low, but nobody has touched about a very sensitive topic, which is affecting the number of investors, not because of the theory, but because of how it is being practiced, is this anti-money laundering and terrorist financing rules and regulation that have come into play. Unfortunately, what's happening that the audit that has been done of the brokers, the type of questions and type of issues that has been raised at the broker level is such that in Pakistan, number of investors, which is judged in terms of UIN, is not rising, but it's falling. This is happening only in Pakistan. It's not the whether it's rising or not rising, it's falling. And I think it has been unfortunate that similar questions are not being asked with the bank, and there are hardly any questions being asked with the National Savings Scheme. So that is, again, a very sensitive and a very big problem. Last and but not the least is the bond market. I totally agree with what Ali Sultan has been saying and what Naz has said, but
oops. Oops, did we lose him? I'm sorry, we probably lost him. Okay. Let's take Mr. There's somebody called Admin CBK993. Who is that? I don't know. I don't know the name. But there's somebody who's raised their hands. Admin. Ji, kaun hai?
Yes.
Ji, boliye. You can introduce yourself,
Ji. Thank you, Rinsab, and thanks to all the panelists for a very insightful conversation. It appears that excessive government borrowing has been the primary reason for undermining financial intermediation. I mean, we look at the banking side, credit to GDP ratio around 13-14%, ADR, again, very low. So it suggests that the government, being the dominant borrower, has virtually undermined the entire financial intermediation process. Similarly, as other panelists have talked about, the national savings schemes has been the key reason for probably the lack of development in the corporate debt market. At least this is what many of the speakers have referred to. So my question is that while we understand the need for the government borrowing, at least the size of it, but what I'm kind of puzzled is that why the government has not been able to at least fix the return part. I mean, why the government is paying excessive returns despite the fact that it's risk-free borrowing compared to corporate sector, for instance, because the size could be one element, but at least government could have brought down the return, in particular in the national savings scheme, where in the name of protecting the vulnerables and elderly and the pensioners, they are offering incentives which basically pass on the risk to the government, I mean, interest rate risk.
Okay.
So I would like the panelists to, at least if they can, respond to the question of, is it the sheer incompetence or something else which stops government from at least fixing the return part?
Okay, let's go to Asad Ali Shah, sir.
Can you hear me, Nadeem Sahab?
We can hear you. We can hear you. Go ahead.
First of all, I think congratulations. I've heard the speakers. The seminar, webinar has been excellent, very insightful. My question from some of the panelists, especially Dr. Amjad Vahid, is that he obviously was very critical of the regulations and the regulator. I think in the last 1.5 years, we have tried to address virtually everything at least that we knew of. I'm saying as a member of the policy board. So I would really like panelists to let us know where we need to further improve. I'm always accessible, the policy member, board member, I can understand perhaps the commission ka to thoda sa wo relationship hota hai na, thoda fear ka, thoda regulator se dar bhi lagta hai, but as far as the policy board members are concerned, they are accessible to all the panelists. Please let us know how can we are all for deregulation and cutting the regulation. I think the entire board is for that, and whatever is left, we will go out of the way to, help you to expand the market and improve the investment climate and, capital formation in this country.
So
this was just my comment and question. Maybe I think Dr. Amjad or someone can point out what is what we have to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tahir Dinsa Sahab. Then we'll go to the panel. Tahir Dinsa. Tahir, you haven't unmuted your mic. Tahir, unmute your mic. Tahir, sir, mic is unmuted.
Sir, unka mic unmute hai, lekin wo unki awaaz nahi aa rahi, sir.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Chale, Tahir, sir, then we'll... Who's introducing the distortion? Ahmed, do you want to ask anything?
Sir, I just have a very small, quick question, very, very small. And this is basically, I really didn't get an answer, and this is for the gentleman from Atlas Asset Management. Okay. Basically, there is a huge bunch of unfunded pension mandates, starting with Pakistan Railways, the SOEs in Pakistan. Where is that discussion, and why is that not pumping money into this pension fund market? This is the quick question.
Great. Okay. If there's nobody else, let me go back to the panel. Okay, folks. Well, why don't you begin, Mr. Asim, since you were given the last chance. So why don't you go ahead, Asim Saab?
Asim, okay. You need to unmute.
Asim Saab, can you hear me?
Sir.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Jeev, I can.
So I would request to give you just a tale from where I have to pick. I kind of bit disconnected during the period. So where would you expect me to respond to?
Jo bhi aapko sawal, jo bhi ye sawal hai, whichever you like. I mean, that's your choice now. Whatever you like of the questions that have been asked by the audience, whatever you feel like responding to, go ahead.
So in terms of, I think general market there was again asked about with respect to market penetration, with respect to about incidence of regulatory burden. Someone pointed about KYC and these effects. These are not generally, obviously, not my area of expertise. But I personally also feel that over the period, we have recently seen that the incidence of new investors coming to market has reduced. So we are passing through a very painful phase in terms of that because of very strict implementation. I would rather leave it to regulatory agencies to look at. The overall number of investors probably is getting shrunk. I'd just like to quickly share one stat is that during this lockdown in particular, in India, I think there were about 1.2 million investors that have been added to the stock market because of use of technology, because of access of again, the financial markets towards that. I'm not sure if our financial system, if our regulations would encourage that kind of participation. I think these are true regulatory burdens that we are also.
Okay. Great. Thank you, G. Naz BP, would you like to answer something?
G, thank you. Let me just first comment on what Asad Saab was saying. I think the SECP and the policy board in this last year and a half has actually been very, very open. And I think Farooq will also attest to that. They've been very welcoming in terms of any changes that need to be made. So I think that's been a very good thing. I think some of the changes that need to happen, like I said, are structural. National savings schemes being a big one. And someone, it is beyond my comprehension why the government continues to pay such high rates of return. So that's one area that needs to be addressed. The other thing I'd say is that, you know, and I'm going to quote Salim Raza here, where he said that development is not a shareholder business. It's a stakeholder business. All of us, whether it's corporates, whether it's investors, everyone will look out for their value proposition. When you want to come and develop the market, the government has to play some role here. So whether it's the national savings or aapne khud ek figure diya tha ke 765 billion ki corporate debt market. Aapko pata hai uske andar 400 billion to sirf energy sukuk hai. Right, which came out just recently, 200 billion each, right? 400 is just that. So why didn't the government come out and try to get retail investors on that? No, they in fact made it SLR eligible. So even easier just to go place it with banks. So, you know, you need to look at some of these things. So I think it's really driven from the government side. Then the other thing that you said is, again, is there industrialization happening? Is there actually a dire need for capital? If that need for capital is not there, whether it's the debt market or whether it's the equity market, you're not going to see the issues come in. The need for capital is at the government level. And unfortunately, a lot of our largest entities are government. They're not privatized. So again, it will come from government. So for capital markets, we can only serve the need that's there. But if the need is not there and it's from government, then you're not going to see this happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jeet. Thank you, Sultan Saab. Sultan sir.
Yes, sir. Let me just touch a few points again, more onto the debt capital market side. I would say that more issues should come, and this was the energy sukuk was a landmark to the book building process, and I would suggest more and more issues should come, particularly long term and where government is guaranteed. And for example, still, I would suggest that Neelam, Jhelum and Dhasu, long projects, were bought by only few banks through the syndicated loan. That was a criminal act, by the way, I would say. I think those issues still can come to the stock exchange, being the technical listing, and so that can be. And the size is huge, 144 billion and 110 billion. So I would suggest, Asasab from the policy, and Farooq is also here, and I'm talking these two issues for long. I think this should come again at the stock exchange. That will give more depth to the market. Second is every year we do commodity operation backed by provincial guarantees. So I think this should come at the stock exchange through the commercial paper kind of thing. So again, government guaranteed, and there's a huge liquidity is there sitting on the Islamic side, and these structures can be built up, more Islamic structures. So eventually, government will benefit when they create a competition between the diverse investors, mm-hmm. and so that transparency will come into play and the price competition will come into play. One part on the banking sector, and we are also planning that they should come up. They are coming up launching their tier one and tier two capitals, but now I think they should come up as internationally we have seen EMTN, Euro Money, Euro Medium Term Notes structures programs. Here in Pakistan, we call it a book building, a shelf registration process. So banks, they can also tap beyond their tier one and tier two capital as an alternate to deposit and launch at the stock exchange. So these are from the issue side. And now I think national saving, everyone has talked that institutional investors should be barred to access the national savings, including the employee funds. That has done at one time, I can recall, during the Shaukat Aziz time. But again, I think till that time, the free put option and the accessibility of the national savings scheme is there for institutional investors. I think this market will never develop, at least in my before my career time. So I think a trading platform, I already talked, branches have failed. Absolutely, they have failed to market these securities because of the cannibalization mindset. So I think now the electronic trading platform can play into role, and they can access, and this is the time so that everyone can go on online and buy and sell. So these are my few suggestions.
Thank you, thank you. Habib Saab. Habib Saab left.
Yeah. Habib Saab, may I make some few observations?
Ji, ek second mein
ye panel.
Chale, Shamim Saab aap kar le. Shamim Saab pehle.
Yeah, I think just a couple of
Shamim Saab, the former regulator, the maker of FCCB. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ji. Thank you so much. I've seen the market grow. I've seen ups and downs of the market over a long period of time. So I think it's been an excellent. I think I must congratulate you and Naseem Beg Saab for organizing this excellent webinar. We have had a very, very good discussion. I think I've attended many of such seminars, but it's been a very good discussion, of course. I think that I think most of the issues have been touched in this webinar. I'll just say that the two issues which have not been discussed. One is the absence of a long-term financing institution in this country. Mm-hmm. I think now we know that in the earlier years, it's the development financing institutions and even ICP used to play a role in bringing the companies to the market. And I think now since there is now an absence of any such institution for long-term financing or for infrastructure financing, I think I think is one of the gaps in our financial system. And secondly, I think we have had an excellent presentation on life insurance from Mr. Muhammad Ali. And I was very, very, I think he touched on some very important issues. But I think that one of the most important issues in the development of life insurance is, of course, the fact that the more than 50% of life insurance business still remains with the public sector. We have the state life, and of course we have the NIC, which is the National Insurance Corporation, which has the monopoly of insuring all the assets of public sector assets. And of course, state life is a monolithic organization. And I think, thirdly, I would say that the reinsurance company, which is the Pakistan Reinsurance Company, PRCL, again, I think in the public sector. So I think the insurance companies still remain in the public sector. And I don't think I need to make any comment on their approach to are their development, I mean, as compared to the some other countries where the, even the public sector companies have done a very, very good job. So I think these are two issues I thought they have been missing, but rest, I would say it has been an excellent, very well organized.
Very good point, G. Wahab Saab, do you want to say something quickly? Then we'll go back to the panel.
Assalamu alaikum, G. Bahut acha session tha. Chhota sa main ek short sa sawal karunga. अब बहुत अच्छी सीखने को चीजें मिली हैं. एक पॉइंट उसमें रह गया था वो ये कि गवर्नमेंट की तरफ से भी डेफिनेटली काफी इम्फेसाइज किया जा रहा है. SECP भी है, उसके बाद पाकिस्तान स्टॉक एक्सचेंज भी है. ये फाइनेंशियल लिटरेसी की तरफ थोड़ा इन्होंने कंट्रीब्यूशन भी किया कि हमारे मुल्क के अंदर जहाँ पे इतना प्रॉब्लम्स आ रहे हैं उसमें एक बहुत बड़ा जो इशू आ रहा है वो ये आ रहा है कि हमारे लोगों के पास अवेयरनेस नहीं है, फाइनेंशियल लिटरेसी का बिल्कुल नहीं पता. और इवन मैं क्योंकि एक म्यूचुअल फंड इंडस्ट्री से मेरा ताल्लुक है और मैं एक स्टूडेंट भी हूँ, तो मैंने एक रिसर्च भी कंडक्ट की. तो मैंने रिसर्च भी जो कंडक्ट की उसमें मैंने अपने ही कस्टमर जो थे उन्हीं से डाटा भी कलेक्ट किया. तो मैं बड़ा मतलब बहुत हैरानगी हुई मुझे देख के कि वो क्लाइंट जो म्यूचुअल फंड के इन्वेस्टर्स हैं, इनफैक्ट वो बड़े थोड़े से क्लाइंट हैं जो म्यूचुअल फंड इंडस्ट्री से जुड़े हुए हैं, क्योंकि मेजॉरिटी को पता ही नहीं है. तो वो जो थे म्यूचुअल फंड इंडस्ट्री से जुड़े हुए, जब उनसे सवालात किए गए म्यूचुअल फंड्स के बारे में या फाइनेंशियल लिटरेसी के बारे में या सेविंग्स के बारे में, तो मैं बड़ा हैरान हुआ रिजल्ट्स देख के कि उसमें से भी 90% से ज्यादा लोगों को बिल्कुल नहीं पता कि वो उन्होंने किस फंड में इन्वेस्टमेंट की हुई है, कहाँ पे इन्वेस्टमेंट की हुई है, उनकी इन्वेस्टमेंट के ऊपर उन्हें रिटर्न क्या मिलेगा. मतलब तो ये कहने का मकसद ये है कि अगर हम फाइनेंशियल लिटरेसी की जो अवेयरनेस है उसको हम गवर्नमेंट लेवल से स्कूल लेवल पे भी लेके आए, स्कूल लेवल पे भी आ जाए एक तरफ, और दूसरा उसमें ऐड करना चाहूंगा हमारे पाकिस्तान में जो बैंकिंग सेक्टर है वो बहुत पैसा कमा रहा है. They are making a lot of money. तो अगर banks भी जो है वो भी थोड़ा सा अपनी spending ads के ऊपर भी spend करते हैं, different जगहों पे spending करते हैं, वो थोड़ी सी financial literacy की awareness के लिए students को और universities में भी वो थोड़ा सा spend कर लें तो बेहतर हो जाएगा.
वहाब साहब, अभी PID ने in collaboration with knowledge platform and state bank financial literacy पे एक पूरा program launch किया जो कि पूरे मुल्क में, शहरों में, स्कूलों में, सब जगह लोगों को दिया जा रहा है फ्री, ताकि बच्चे और बड़े सब सीखें फाइनेंशियल लिटरेसी. तो यस, इसकी तरफ थोड़ा सा ध्यान किया गया है. बट जी, अब चलें आगे जी. डॉक्टर अमजद महीद साहब, वुड यू लाइक टू से समथिंग?
जी, वेरी क्विकली, एक क्वेश्चन आया था लिटरेसी यू नो वर्सेस यू नो इन्वेस्टमेंट इन म्यूचुअल फंड एंड कैपिटल मार्केट्स. ऑब्वियसली लिटरेसी इज अ फैक्टर, मगर अगर हम देखें इंडिया की लिटरेसी कोई हमारे से बहुत बेहतर नहीं है, मगर वहाँ पाकिस्तान में म्यूचुअल फंड में 3 लाख इन्वेस्टर्स हैं और इंडिया में 9 करोड़ इन्वेस्टर्स हैं. अब हमारी पॉपुलेशन 1/7 दैट ऑफ इंडिया है, सो उस हिसाब से हमारे 13 मिलियन होने चाहिए मगर हमारे 0.3 मिलियन है. सो आई थिंक यू नो लिटरेसी इज अ फैक्टर, बट आई थिंक ओवरऑल एनवायरमेंट रेगुलेशंस, वी टॉक अबाउट NSS, देयर आर लॉट ऑफ दीज फैक्टर्स व्हिच आर एन हिंड्रेंस, वी हैव टॉक्ड अबाउट दैट. एक पॉइंट आया था समीर का रिगार्डिंग कॉस्ट ऑफ इंटरमीडिएशन इज हाई, वेदर इट्स इंश्योरेंस और म्यूचुअल फंड्स. आई एग्री विद दैट, द वे कॉस्ट ऑफ इंटरमीडिएशन गोज डाउन इज इकोनॉमीज ऑफ स्केल. जब आपका बिजनेस बढ़ता है तो खुद ब खुद कंपटीशन की वजह से कॉस्ट कम हो जाती है. वो अभी पाकिस्तान में इसलिए नहीं है, एज आई सेड, सिर्फ अगर 3 लाख इन्वेस्टर हैं स्टॉक मार्केट में या 3 लाख इन्वेस्टर हैं म्यूचुअल फंड्स में, तो इतनी इकोनॉमीज ऑफ स्केल नहीं है और इतना कंपटीशन नहीं है कि प्राइसेस इंटरमीडिएशन की नीचे को जाए. असद अली शाह साहब को जो पॉइंट था रिगार्डिंग बेसिकली द रोल ऑफ द रेगुलेटर, आई थिंक आई डिड मेंशन, आई वाज क्रिटिकल हिस्टोरिकली ऑफ द रेगुलेटर, सेइंग के इन्होंने जो प्राइसिंग कंट्रोल्स किए, माइक्रो मैनेज किए, उससे कैपिटल मार्केट्स और म्यूचुअल फंड नहीं ग्रो की. एट द सेम टाइम आई डिड मेंशन के लास्ट कपल ऑफ ईयर्स हैव बीन फिनोमिनल, वी हैव द बेस्ट पॉलिसी बोर्ड एवर, यू नो पीपल लाइक असद अली शाह, you know, Khalid Mirza, you know, a lot of them, Vakar Islam, all of them are thorough professionals. We have very good commission. I think, you know, if you look at the, you know, 4 or 5 commissioners, I think look at their backgrounds, you know, their experience outside Pakistan, their academic experience, their experience within Pakistan. We have the best professional group. And I think it shows. I mean, as far as the mutual fund industry is concerned, I would say 90% of our issues have been addressed in the last, you know, couple of years. The infrastructure regulations, draft regulations that have just come out are excellent, the best I've ever seen, and they came in a very short period. And that should help public-private, you know, infrastructure development going forward. So certainly, I think there's a you know, sea change in terms of the approach of the regulator. I think Sohail raised a point of the trust deficit between the regulator and the regulatee. I think still, I think there has to be more communication between, I think, the regulator and regulatee. Shayad usse agar regular meetings hoti rahein, to a trust deficit khud kam ho jata hai. DFIs, jo Shamim saab ko point tha, certainly, I think, you know, there was a lot of these DFIs, by the way, shut down because of corruption and so on and inefficiencies. I think there's role of some DFIs coming back, but wo zyada tar role capital markets karte hain. Ab DFIs globally bhi kam ho gaye hain because capital markets, bond market, you know, and stock market, they've taken some of that role that DFIs, you know, typically used to do. So I think I've addressed some of these points that were raised.
Okay. I think I've covered everybody except for Farooq. Farooq saab?
Ji, thank you. Again, I think a lot of the points have been addressed, but just very quickly, jo ek education ke bare mein point hua raised, and I think that is a joint responsibility of all the industry players. For example, PSX, you know, we hold regular seminars, and we've continued to do those during this COVID crisis as well at different universities, etc., in Pakistan. In talking about the capital markets, in talking about the financial concepts. And recently, we've had some very good meetings with the education ministry, where hopefully even in the secondary schools, they will be, you know, we're working with them to introduce in the curriculum, you know, information about, you know, financial planning and financial concepts. Because really, it is at that age onwards that people need to, and children need to start becoming familiar with them. Again, Shamim saab ne jo state life or EOBI kiya, and you know, during this crisis, when I you know, met with them, and really my request to them was to follow international best practices with in relation to their investment policies, because EOBI and state life were probably the only pension fund and life assurance company I knew that were not in the world that would not have been taking exposure to equity markets. I mean, they have the long-term capital to be able to, and as was shown earlier, the returns that are available in the market for long-term investors, and it was their policyholders who were the losers, while private insurance companies were, as I mentioned, the largest buyers in the market over the last couple of months. So over the long term, it's the policy holders of these and the beneficiaries of EOBI who will lose out by not their trustees not having taken the right investment decisions. I think Sohail raised some points, and I think the trust deficit, I hope that's certainly one of my major efforts, and is to make sure that we reduce the trust deficit you know, between you know, all the market participants and the regulators, and as has been said by many others, I think we have a unique opportunity right now that we have an extremely open and an extremely forward-looking regulator, both at the policy board level as well as at the SECP, and I think it is up to us to take advantage of that. You know, in terms of education and marketing, I think one point which is important is that as industry players, all of us have to take that responsibility. You know, mutual fund industries, again, you know, how much of their, you talk spoke about R&D, is going into efforts in allocating their budgets for new products, you know, for marketing, and using you know, modern means of marketing. As the gentleman from EFU Life mentioned, I mean, digitalization of distribution has been happening over a decade. Why are we only looking at it right now? I think TPL Tracker is the only, or TPL Insurance is the only sort of really online, you know, insurance company that I know of. So I think all of these we need to, as we talk about the macro environment and look at and talk about, you know, why things are not moving ahead, also need to do introspection. And I'm certainly have a lot of opportunity to do that right now, having recently taken over at PSX. What is it that we are not doing? And again, just to go back to the ETF example, it has been a real struggle. I mean, the AMC should be the one running forward and bringing this in. And here the PSX and the regulator is trying to push forward ETF karein. You know, it's just inverted the you know, where the push and the effort should be coming from for all these innovations and for educating the investors. The billboards being put up in India and Thailand, and the 1.2 million new investors that someone mentioned that have happened, that have come in this crisis, those have not been brought in by the Bombay Stock Exchange or the National Stock Exchange. It's the brokers who have gone out and marketed. I was talking to a large company recently, and they didn't even know that shelf registration is allowed for debt instruments. Now, why haven't the corporate finance groups of all the brokerage houses and banks gone and educated their clients? They are the ones. PSX will not make the money if they do a debt issue. It's their consultants and their advisors who will make the money. Is anyone in the brokerage industry looking at companies' balance sheets and going to companies and saying, we've looked at your balance sheet and this is the kind of structure and instrument that will make sense for you? You know, we did the first commercial paper issue for MobiLink back in the mid-90s. No one is doing that. And we went to them. We said, try this. This works. The regulations are there. And they did it. So I think you know, the brokerage industry, the banking corporate finance group also need to take responsibility for understanding and beating the street to bring in new products and investors.
Fair point. Fair point. Very good. Very good. Well, folks, I hope anybody on the panel that I missed out, or anybody who wants to say something, last chance. Okay. Well, thank you, folks. Sorry.
Nadeem, if you allow me, I missed. I think the speaker from insurance industry highlighted a very serious aspect. Pakistan ka jo penetration hai, insurance penetration is one of the worst, really. Obviously, mutual fund industry bahut kam hai, jaise Dr. Amjad ne bataya. So, one of the issues currently, I would suggest, surprisingly didn't raise, is the tax that has been imposed on the life insurance and the insurance, which is the sales tax, which will be a big, big deterrent. Nowhere in the world insurance is taxed like that, because insurance is not a service. It's a risk contract. It's a hedging contract. So that is one issue I would suggest that apni recommendations mein le hain. There should not be any tax. And I would strongly suggest ye jo aap kar rahe hain webinars, it would be great if focus seminars on these sectorals like insurance, I think, needs much more discussion, and its issues need to be brought in. And of course, one of the common issue in all of that is the culprit is in tax, the fiscal aspect. So, sabse bada issue jo hai ye sari capital market ka jo, I think is just discussed nahi hua, because you know the capital market, mutual fund industry, and insurance, and all of this is documented in industry. And you know there is a disincentive, because overall our economy, abhi jo sugar ki report bhi aayi hai, usse to pata chal raha hai ki jo cheez samjhi jati thi ki wo documented hai, wo bhi documented nahi hai. So probably jo hamari non-documented, you see there is so much incentive for the people, you know, to make money and not pay tax. And on the other hand, agar aapne capital economy mein, mein stock market mein invest karna hai, ya apne mutual fund industry mein, ya insurance mein, to phir aapko 30% 35% tax lag jata hai, aur phir dividend pe alag lagta hai. If you are a corporate and workers welfare fund, workers profit participation fund, so there is a huge disincentive for people to come from informal economy to the formal economy. Ye bahut bada fundamental issue hai, I think, which will remain a detriment, and usko hal karne ka aur tarika nahi hai unless we enhance the documentation and people kind of, you know, we become, the government becomes serious and people who are not documented and who are evading large amounts of taxes, jab tak wo tax net mein nahi aayenge, koi fear nahi hoga, then there is no incentive for very large number of people who make huge amount of money and also not pay tax. Why should they come into this sector? This, I think, is a fundamental issue.
Good. Very good. Well, thank you very much, folks. May I ask Naseem Beg Saab to kind of do the final summing up or concluding comment? Naseem Saab, I think this is something that's best if you sort of take up and sum it up much better than me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The thing is that I think the speakers have covered literally every area that needs to be talked about. The conclusion that I can draw is that the government is caught up in a vicious cycle of working against itself, whether it's in raising expensive debt and crowding out the market, or whether it's, as Asad has just pointed out, the fiscal structures that are detrimental to the market. So really, it is the government of Pakistan that needs to go back to the drawing board and look at why it's stuck in this place where it's crowding out the market, not only the capital market, every aspect of the market development, and then, of course, ending up with expensive debt, which in turn also impacts banking, because banks are sitting pretty with that money. The same banks have their treasury function with a backstop at the lender of last resort, which is again financed by the taxpayer at the end of the day. We've never seen any banks fail. So whichever way we look at it, I think it's the government that needs to rethink. Yes, the industry members have already mentioned where all they are failing and where they need to get on with things, especially on using technology, etc. Some have already started doing it. But, you know, as Amjad pointed out, as opposed to 90 million investors in Indian mutual funds, we have 200 or 300,000. You discount it for that population. We just got a miserable showing everywhere. The only number that was big in numbers, what Naz mentioned, was 7 million investors in the national savings. And just to give you an idea of national savings, even when we talk of this safety net for the baboon type account, 5 million rupees, you give 2.5% extra on it, it works out to roughly 10,000 rupees a month. The poorest of the poor on the BISP, we give 2,000 a month. So someone who has 50 lakh rupiah, we give 10,000 a month to. I mean, we've got silos of giving. Uspe tax break bhi hai. So you give a tax break, you give this extra, there should be just one structure, BISP, SRs, call it what, and just support everyone through that. Nothing else. Otherwise, we'll have these distortions and everything ends up costing the government, which means the taxpayer. That's my summary of it.
It seems, sir, before we go, just a quick question. I think all of us have been discussing this issue for decades now. I've become an old man discussing these things. How can we bring about a change? I think without financial markets, we all agree, despite the 2008 crisis and despite so much acrimony that finance has got, financial markets are still important. Yes, of course, they can cause damage too, but they're also important. How can we all pull together and develop some ideas that can probably, or at least have a dialogue with the government that, look, the government also should be interested in developing the capital markets. How can we facilitate the dialogue? PID is an important think tank. How can we help you facilitate the dialogue?
I think PID is seen as independent. When industry members go, if it's the insurance industry or the mutual fund industry or the stock exchange, they are all seen as either fat cats or as those who are trying to get the better of the government, because we also, let's not forget, have a big rent-seeking economy. Yeah. And so each one of us as an industry member is seen as a rent-seeker when we turn up in Islamabad. So it has to be independent research, and I think PID, perhaps others, this type of dialogue will help. individually, whenever, I mean, Amjad might make an excellent point on the national savings, but it's seen with a lot of suspicion. So that will remain the case, whether it's Farooq going with the stock exchange, the insurance industry, they're not going to be listened to because of the overall suspicion, and some of it very well placed because all of us have been able to get protections of sort, sort of tax arbitrage arrangements of sort. So all of us work around that to protect ourselves. Independent research like yours or others with open dialogue is the only answer.
Well, thank you very much. We intend to do this. We intend to, PID's job is this, and I think we intend to keep hitting on these themes so that we can talk to the government, talk to you people, learn from you, act like a conduit, and we will certainly do that. So people like Naseem Saab, help us. Naseem Saab, you're a good friend, and we seriously appreciate you. All of you folks, you're busy people, take out time on Saturday morning. We really appreciate you. Thank you very much. You've really helped us people, our students, us understand this market better. We will, inshallah, do a lot of theses on your market, try and understand it, try and develop the dialogue through our research. So thank you, folks. I sincerely thank you from the bottom of my heart.
I'd like to thank all the panelists and, of course, the valuable input from others.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The office.
The office.